The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
All right, it is Friday the 13th of December. You're welcome along to OTB AM. As always, we begin on Friday with some highbrow political conversation. I'm delighted to say to do that. We have Johnny Ward in studio with us this morning. Johnny, how are you getting on? You were specially seconded in to get rid of Owen because we knew there was some serious political issues at play this morning, and you were really the only man for the job.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was Friday the 13th. It makes a lot of sense, actually, when you wake up to the reality of Donald Trump and Boris Johnson as the elected leaders of the two great or formerly great Western powers, two utter buffoons elected by the people. It's a worrying day for democracy. I know they wanted to get Brexit done, but could you vote for Boris Johnson, the guy who was hiding in a fridge from a reporter the other day?
A vast majority of Britain weren't, as frequently these things play out, they weren't necessarily voting for Boris Johnson.
They're voting for Brexit.
I like this guy rather than that guy, and whatever party they are, they are. Like, it's not always sort of with Boris Johnson in mind that somebody cast their vote for the Conservatives. That's the fortunate or unfortunate, whatever way you want to look at it. An interesting, no doubt,
concept. There were alternatives to Corbyn, though. Do you know what I mean? If you didn't want to vote Corbyn. But I think United Ireland, I would say, almost looks more likely than not now at this stage, or certainly in my lifetime, because Scotland will surely vote for independence after the SNP's vote. Unionists in the north have a strong tie to Scotland historically, and if Scotland is taken away from the United Kingdom, Northern Ireland is a basket case economically as it is. It has absolutely no reason to support the UK economically because it's fallen. About the GDP in the north is about half what it is in the south now. So that's been a massive transformation, whereas at the start of 100 years ago, Dublin was miles behind Belfast. That's completely changed.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited and energised by that, and the fact that the DUP, the unionist vote, certainly there are going to be more nationalist seats than unionist seats in Northern Ireland. Now, that may not always be the case, but I'm very energised by that. I think United Ireland probably will happen now, but in terms of the people in Britain, what they voted for last night, I think democracy is in a pretty questionable place at the moment.
I would be far from somebody who would be in any position to comment on any of these things.
But I'm just a normal voter like yourself.
The only thing that I saw last night was that somebody was actually making the point that the Conservatives actually now, and the vast majority, we'll stop talking politics in a second, by the way, for anybody who's totally disinterested, but the fact that the Conservatives have won a landslide, massive majority in the House now, that actually their policies will have to be more centrist than they had initially outlined, and that, you know, they can't necessarily tax the hell out of the high polloi, the great unwashed, that actually they're going to have to engage with, because they have a mandate for everybody now, that it wasn't just the upper and middle classes that have voted them in.
That's Dave McWilliams made that point there last night, which I think may well be valid, because they've won seats where traditionally they would never have won seats, and it's almost like John Finucane representing the people of North Belfast. He has a mandate for people. John Finucane must have been voted for by moderate Protestants or moderate Unionists, because otherwise why would he have gotten the vote? But you just hope that Boris kind of chills out a bit on some of his pronouncements, because the more I read in it, his promises on Brexit aren't really achievable in the time frame. But I think the overwhelming thing about this vote was that British people are fed up with Brexit and just want to get it out of the way and get on with their lives. Mm. And Corbyn obviously was procrastinating on that and talking of a second referendum. But I still think it's deeply worrying that a guy that... I mean, if you were having a pint with Kim Jong-un, Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, you'd think, like, who the hell are these people? They're like, these guys are crazy. Mm. But they're leading like a new country and the two great powers in the West, or the two great former powers. It's actually quite frightening.
Do you think Kim Jong-un will be into a pint?
His father was big into cognac, massive. He loved his cognac. I'd say he likes the finer things in life. He looks like he does, doesn't he?
I mean,
while
a pint,
people starve.
Specifically, a
pint of Guinness. I mean, who wouldn't? I'd say Bojo would like a pint of Guinness. Trump would like a pint. Do you like a pint of Guinness?
I wouldn't mind a pint of Guinness right now.
Right now, half seven in the morning, Adrian.
Speaking of sort of things that people are want out of their lives and to move on with their life. The Dublin footballers have a new manager. There's another thing that you were, I'm sure, very excited about last night. Desi Farrell's come in. I'm sure that you might have been living on sort of planet Zog to have not spotted this one over the last 18 hours or thereabouts. The Dublin County Board convened last night. Whispers started to emerge about 2 hours before the 7 o'clock meeting that Desi Farrell was going to get the gig, and that's exactly what happened. He's getting in a 3-year term. A lot of positive soundings out of some of the all-guard in Dublin, some of whom who would have played alongside him. Yet to reveal his backroom staff, some indication that McGavin might be amongst those. Some indication that, from Shane Hannon, a conversation with some of the Dublin administrators down at Parnell Park last night, that also some of his, some of Jim Gavin's backroom staff are going to stay on. Obviously, who they will be, we will see. Jason Sherlock was obviously a former teammate of Desi's as well. So, interesting times. Like, whether, I suppose we'll get to see whether Jim was a genius or not over the next few years.
Yeah, that might be a little bit harsh because, you know, sometimes circumstances happen and the stars align, and it's a great job, but it's also like, you know, you're taking over from a legend. What more can you achieve? But I think from Dublin's perspective, the shock of, when you consider the shock of the resignation, they've gotten this done pretty quickly. Now, it would have been a job that lots of people wanted. Like, compare that to the Galway situation in the hurling, where they've gone on, the players more or less had to start training themselves, because so I think it'll be seamless. It probably does give the others a bit of hope, because whatever Jim had and the way he delegated responsibility and trust to the players, he had something very special. So With all due respect to Jim Gavin, his departure is probably good for football in the greater sense, because people are definitely fed up with Dublin winning all the time. And, you know, Damien Delaney in during the week, he's like, I wouldn't really watch football now, only certain games. I think a lot of people are like that. As much as I think football is actually in a great place in many ways, I just think Dublin are too dominant for the general interest. A bit like Kenny dragging the standards up, but people got fed up with them winning.
Yeah, same as in racing. Were, but I mean, like, what are they on about when you're watching, when you're alive at a time when there's a team as dominant as Kilkenny, as dominant as Dublin, and as annoying as it might be if you're from a very limited number of counties, if you're a Kerry, Mayo, for example, Galway to a degree, I'm sure that's frustrating. But like, for people like myself who wouldn't have any vested interest and are not going to have it anytime soon, I think that, like, it's unbelievable to be alive at a time where you're seeing such dominance, a team that's going to be spoken about for years. By the way, he's got 6 weeks before the league starts.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, that's
bang, bang.
And first up, Kerry. Like, this is not a, this is a very tight turnaround. That was the one shock for me when everybody was talking about Gavin and whether he was going to stay on or not. I thought, surely he's not leaving it this late. Like, he's not giving the next guy in.
Yeah, like, I suppose that it obviously would prompt some questions as to why he did it at that time. But I obviously, Jim has a lot going on in terms of his work life and all that. But like, that Dublin Kerry game becomes really fascinating now, because Kerry obviously were close to them. Kerry will have their motivation up, and it builds into the league very nicely. Yeah. And you know, if you look at the league and the change of the structures, the league will be a lot more interesting to people than a vast portion of the Championship this year, because they're competitive games. And you're from Leinster, obviously, you can attest to the dead rubber that's become. So that game looks fascinating now, and it's a nice little build up for the GAA to kind of promote the league going into that Dublin. Is that Dublin Kerry game? Is that in Croke Park?
I'm not sure, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So where, if that game were in Croke Park, you could see a huge crowd at it. Yeah. I'd say.
The only difficulty is, does it? I mean, to a degree, does it really matter? What happens? Like, what I'm saying is, you could easily see Kerry go on and win the thing, and then what sort of relevance that'll have?
Yeah, Tyrone won in Croke Park last year, and that didn't matter.
And this is in Croke Park as well, by the way.
Yeah, so you could imagine there'll be a huge crowd at that, with a lot of, what's this Dublin team going to be like? And it'll be fascinating. I don't know Desi, but I mean, it was pretty obvious that he was the odds-on favourite from the get-go.
Not many people do, is the thing. He's kind of post-GPA. We've not really seen very much of him, is the one thing. We're going to have plenty of conversation.
Sounds like a Dublin manager then, doesn't he?
Yeah, I know, but we're not going to hear very much of that. Might continue, to be fair. Plenty of conversation about Desi as the morning unfolds. We've also got a very big quarter-final for you. This morning, anybody's been paying attention over the last few weeks as we search for Irish sports moment of the decade.
There's a lot of ball. There is a goal! Robbie Brady!
Most memorable moment of the decade, of course, Johnny, is the correct terminology here, and it's very important because the parameters of this debate have swung this way and that over the last little while. This morning, it's going to be Shane Lowry, Open 2019 champion, first Irishman on Irish soil to win the British Open Championship, versus Johnny Sexton's drop goal in the Grand Slam game against what materialised to be the Grand Slam against France.
Yeah, I'm not.
What are you having?
That's
your vote, Johnny. Come on,
may not be a rugby man, but I'm certainly not a golf man. But it's easy to kind of love Shane Lowry, and I think that particular victory was a lot more about golf. It was about this lad who like is basically an Offaly football and hurling fan who is one of us. Like essentially, golf may be aloof in many ways, but I think we can relate to Lowry, and everyone basically seems to love him. And you know, coming from the amateur game like he did. I don't know, Adrian. I don't know.
Where are you casting your vote, Johnny, is what I'm asking you.
I'll go with Lowry.
Yeah. I'm in the Lowry camp, I have to say. Both moments actually were very un-Irish, I felt. That the Lowry one, sort it wasn't quite wire to wire, but it was close. He was maybe one shot back, I think, at JB Holmes after the first day, and then was ahead every other day after that. And obviously, Rom-Tom, whatever it was, six shots in the end. Like, very un-Irish. And then the drop goal was also very un-Irish in that we snatched victory from the jaws of defeat at the last minute with an unbelievable bit of skill.
Is the Six Nations all a bit tainted in the narrative of the last decade for Ireland? Is that like, because we go into 2020 with the Irish rugby team, we're thinking, well, we were crap again at the World Cup. So, like, how important is the Six Nations upcoming? I would say it's very important, but at the same time, if we were very good in the Six Nations, like, well, that's grand, but like we still can't do it on the global stage.
It's the least important of it's always the least important of the cycle of Six Nations, I suppose, given it's removed from the World Cup. But like, I think that's only hindsight. Because at the time when that drop goal goes over, you're losing your mind.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know? And I, as a newly formed rugby man, you know, going to the game tomorrow, whoever Leinster are playing, I do know Northampton. I genuinely am really looking forward to the Six Nations. I think because again, like Desi Farrell, there's a new regime. I think Farrell will have to change things pretty drastically in terms of the way we play. I think a bit like the football team, the Irish rugby public were getting a little bit fed up with the style of play in the end under Schmidt. I don't know what you think. You'd know a lot more about me, but I think Farrell will try to Farrells, of course. I think Andy Farrell will try to develop a bit more of our off the cuff stuff.
That's going to be the greatest line of the morning. Two Farrells, of course, which is not a thought that had overly struck me, I have to say. But I don't know. Look,
both taken over from legends, albeit one slightly tainted by the end.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Anyway, let's not sort of linger very much on Ireland's World Cup campaign because there's nothing more to add on it. But
they could easily win the Six Nations. Like they could be a little bet for that because they were odds on favourites last year. Now I think they're 4-1, 9-2.
And we will get very excited about it if that happens. But like you say, in the grand scheme of things, really, what's it matter? Because we've become so bloody obsessed now with this World Cup thing. We'll probably forget about it in 18 months' time. But for now, we get to linger in a little bit more. So anyway, look, that's the debate of the morning. We're actually going to hear a little bit later on from one side of that. A debate from the Shane Lowry coach, Neil Manship. That's coming your way a little bit later on. But here's a flavour of what's coming your way between now and 9:30 with Johnny and myself. We're going to get stuck into the sports pages in just a minute. Desi obviously tending to dominate a lot of those. Kenny Cunningham is going to join us at around 8 o'clock. It's an interesting enough weekend, actually, of Premier League football on the way. So we're going to talk to Kenny about all of that. We're going to discuss Desi Farrell in the company of Kieran Cunningham. That's on the way a little bit later in the show as well, at about 8:20 or thereabouts. So if you've any comments, questions, or any of that stuff, do get them in. We're going to discuss our Sexton-Lowry debate. It is the hot debate of the day, and you can weigh in with your vote if you head along to the...
And we changed the font there.
Twitter feed. Yeah, brand new sort of branding launch. Good to know you've been paying attention for the week, Johnny. It's only been a place since Monday. But
what do you make of that? Because you see the business
sure
post.
This, you hosted the show one night this week.
No, sure this day last week.
Well, were you not on the Off the Ball evening show at some point this week?
What's that?
You hosted the...
I hosted it on Wednesday evening. That was a long, long day because it was like the soccer the racing awards were the night before. Then we did some racing stuff in the morning and stretched all the way to 10 o'clock. My stamina is definitely on the wane,
You were... It was a late one and you were struggling.
It was late enough, yeah. It was just... but I think by the time the awards were actually giving out, it was like 11:30, and that's a fair bit of wine. Like if you're at the table for 4 hours, which we were at that stage, and as much as you could have been like Jim Bulger was sitting beside me, and the lady coming to the table, she kept saying to Jim Bulger, would you like some more wine, sir? Would you like some more wine? Jim Bulger has been teetotal forever, and everyone knows that in racing. I'm pretty sure he probably was wearing his Pioneer badge. But I got great enjoyment out of the fact that she persisted and asked him, did he want some wine? She kept asking me, and I did want wine. So by 11:30, I was like, well, this is your chance now to actually mingle with racing people. It's the only chance a year where you can mingle with so many race people, be it like JP McManus was there, Aidan O'Brien, Eddie O'Leary and so forth. So it would have been rude to go home. At least that was the slant I was putting on.
That's your logic. That's fair enough. Daryl O'Toole was in touch to say that
Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong was on the lash apparently when he was a young lad in
Switzerland.
College in Switzerland.
I'm not sure where he got that data. I've watched a few documentaries on Kim Jong-un and they've referenced this shy basketball fan who was okay at his studies, but they never referenced him being on the lash, so that should be in the next North Korea documentary. He likes the booze.
Here's what else is on the show for you this morning, coming up a little bit later on. We also are going to be joined by Alan Quinlan. What a weekend of Heineken Champions Cup as well, to look ahead to all the provinces in action getting underway this evening. Quinny is going to preview all of that for us. Enda McNulty is going to also give us his considerations on the appointment of Desi Farrell. He's a former teammate, obviously, and would have played against Desi over the years in the various county shirts as well. So we'll get Enda's thoughts on that as well. And, of course, we may also get his thoughts on Ireland's shortcomings at the Rugby World Cup as well, having been involved there. And as I mentioned, Neil Manship is Shane Lowry's main coach and is going to join us on the line at about 9:20. I wonder which way he's going to vote in our poll of the day, Shane Lowry versus Johnny Sexton. So that's what's on the way between now and 9:30 for you this morning. First of all, let's get stuck into the back pages. OTB AM. All right, just gone 8:15 on this Friday morning. Delighted to have you along. You're watching OTB AM. It's the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. Whatever your comments are for the morning, whether they're Kim Jong-un related or not, sort of keen to hear from you. Going to kick things off with the Irish Daily Star this morning. Primarily, I had to read this headline 5 times, Johnny. I mean, I know that's more of a reflection on me than it is the headline writer, but I eventually got it.
Christmas. Well, it's a play on Carroll, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you should have gotten that.
Really. I should have done. Yeah. It was last night, actually, when I saw it. And maybe I was a bit sort of tired and emotional. Christmas.
Here's one for you, right? Yeah. Of the two Farrells, whose reign will be better? That'd be an interesting poll, wouldn't it?
I probably think this guy.
He's probably set up.
He's coming off the back of a 5 in a row. He's probably set up. It's probably predetermined that he's going
to. Expectations are like right to the ceiling, though. Whereas, obviously, with Andy Farrell, it's like, well, you've time to bed things, try new things here.
Yeah.
The team doesn't look anywhere near as good as it did a year ago. Whereas he's basically expected to win All Ireland every year.
Well, the other thing is, if Ireland do win the Six Nations every year for the next 3 or 4 years, like, people would be like, oh yeah, that's great, but like,
what about the World Cup?
So that's the difficulty that he has. New Dubs boss hoping veteran Cluxton will give him the perfect gift of staying on, writes Kieran Cunningham there, and we'll talk to Kieran in just a little bit. Cop Pip United to Minamino. This is the news that Jurgen Klopp seems to have snatched Takumi Minamino from under the nose of Manchester United for a knockdown. I think it's £7 million, something like that, from Red Bull Salzburg. An FAI opposed division, writes Mark McCadden here. The FAI looks set to come out against proposals made by a number of rank and file members to split the association, a move that wouldn't go down well, he says, with FIFA. That's the Irish Daily Star this morning.
Yeah, the Daily Mail, Pep's secret release clause. Boss could leave at the end of the season with City Chiefs big admirers of Pochettino. Favourite Farrell is the choice for Dublin. Just want to reference Philip Quinn's article on page 49. This is to do with the meeting of the schoolboy FAI, tomorrow evening, I think.
It's a possible disbanding of the under-13 league.
Yeah, I've been speaking to a few guys, so it's obviously Troy Parrott here and Connolly, but calls the under-13 league to be disbanded. And Philip's on about, I think this meeting is tomorrow night where the SFAI EGM takes place. But there's a big argument that the under-13 league, I've spoken to a few people from sort of the nursery clubs. And as much as they've vested interest in terms of what happens with underage football, they would make a good point that the League of Ireland clubs, a lot of them aren't particularly well set up for underage teams. Because this was kind of all foisted upon them. It was one of the things John Delaney was sort of responsible for that I think was very positive, that there's a League of Ireland underage team from under 13 up now. But there's no bridge from 13 to 15. And that, the guy I spoke to from one of the clubs said that if your local League of Ireland team takes a scatter of players from your club some of their mates get uninterested and the club can kind of, he said a lot of underage teams have actually disbanded on account of this. But there's another big issue that if you're a 13-year-old and you're good, but you're deemed not quite good enough to be under 15 the following year, that it's very, it's almost too ruthless for a kid of that age. Now I think we can be a little bit, too like protective about, like, the, you know, we all were on it. We were all like players at some age or at some class when we were younger, and we had good days and bad days, and you kind of had to get on with it. But it is a good point that 13 to 15 is probably a bit of a big gap. Especially if that 13-year-old is a young 13-year-old.
I was at an under-12 games, as it would happen a couple of weeks ago, and just the kids are so young. Like, there was definitely some players that you would look at and go, Jesus, they were good, they were clearly good. There was like a lad playing centre-back that clearly should have been sort of middle of the park, dictating play. Like, there was lads that you could identify that were very good. But at the same time, you were definitely looking at it going, there are players there who will probably come on and come on and come on. And the idea that, you know, at that level, you're obviously singling them out for sort of, this guy's destined for greatness and that he's going to be plucked from probably by some either League of Ireland club or beyond. That gap, what I'm saying is that gap at that age group for it's suddenly big. To have been that, to now suddenly be going to under 15 after that seems...
It's big, yeah. I think, like, from my own experience, I think it's very important for coaches at that age, whether it's your school team or whatever team it is, not to be totally governed by the victory of the game. Just like make sure to, these are kids, educate them in the skills of the game more so than tactics, and educate them in giving them game time, even if you think, even if it's 5-10 minutes, give them game time, because it's alienating being on the sideline.
Six Shooter writes the Irish Examiner this morning, this is obviously in relation to Desi again, after Gavin Era's famous five, Desi Farrell chosen to lead Dublin search for six in a row. Plenty more inside as well, including Ronan Agar. All Blacks have missed a trick by not appointing Scott Robertson. This is the guy that he worked under at the Crusaders, of course, who was one of the favourites. And certainly it seems as if he was into the last two to possibly get that All Blacks gig. But it's gone for Ian Foster. They've gone for Ian Foster and says, instead, Rog says inside, I do wonder, was Razor Robertson even over the heads of some of the decision makers in this process? That he might have just, his presentation might have been just a bit too much for them.
The Sun, Christmas Prezi Desi, Farrell has handed the reins. Interesting other Dublin related story. Also, I should mention this, John Early has resigned from the FAI. I think the FAI sent a statement out at 10 past 10. And in these times, I can't get my head around the optics of, like, they really should be on the greatest charm offensive of all time at the moment. Obviously, Paul Cook is in, and people don't blame Paul Cook for what's gone on. But, I mean, why are they sending out these important statements at 10 past 10? Just on page 43, Dubs, Kenny Wade to start. It's obviously another little pun there. But don't forget about the Dublin Hurlers, who knocked Galway out of the championship last year and are rebuilding very, very nicely. Keane Boland, one of their stars, was swanning himself around at the HRI Awards the other night. He works for HRI, big racing man. So he's I'm sure he's buzzing to get going. Don't ride off Dublin this year.
The Irish Independent on this Friday morning, there's no sort of front page as such, but the main lead is in relation to Desi Farrell, of course, and Colm Key's thoughts there. Desi won't be intimidated by a room full of all-time greats, and primarily, and it's very much the theme across a lot of the papers, primarily because he knows most of them, he's coached most of them. As one of the writers writes this morning, that he won't have to introduce himself to too many in that Dublin dressing room.
Yeah, this is, might as well put this in the front. There's Boris with his dog. I don't know if, did the dog look like he or she was really enjoying the trip to Downing Street yesterday?
Where does Boris's hair end and the dog start is probably the main question I would have out of that.
Dylan the dog, D-I-L-Y-N, which is an abomination of a spelling as well.
I know that obviously Dylan Thomas was a Welsh guy and spelt it very differently, but it does sound a little bit Welsh.
The British have very, very strange names. Like, they've a large array of strange surnames and so forth, and strange leaders, as it turns out. At the front, at the back, Guardiola City deal has break clause. Hamilton had Ferrari talks. Ferrari admitted that he spoke to Lewis Hamilton. Klopp to sign Salzburg star.
The Irish Times this morning. It's rugby all the way here. Gerry Thornley, more settled. Ulster have what it takes to pass Stern's Stoop test. Writes Jerry there, ahead of Harlequins against Ulster, which is tonight at 7:45 at the Stoop. And Matt Williams is an interesting piece there, which is an open letter to Conor Murray and Ross Byrne. And the short story, particularly in relation to Ross Byrne, is to, he wants to see a bit more arrogance from him, that he thinks he's a bit too gentlemanly and actually would like to see him sort of puff his chest out and try and dominate games, because he is sure as hell going to get his opportunity now to put his flag in the ground to be that Ireland first choice 10.
Is Sexton's loss to Leinster even a blow? Would you call it a blow, or does it really matter at this stage?
I mean, I think if you were picking, if you're asking who's a better 10, is that the ultimate question?
Like, is he?
I mean, I don't think
Sexton, with his injuries as well, he's obviously regressing a little bit at this stage.
Well, I think because of Byrne's undoubted quality, to describe it as a blow would probably be too much, in the way that it might have been sort of, let's say, pre Carberry's departure, where neither of them, they were kind of splitting things themselves and Carberry, and neither of them were getting probably the opportunity they wanted. So it's not a seismic dent, I suppose, that it might have been a couple of years ago. But like, if you were asking who's the better out half currently, if we were heading into a World Cup, Johnny, let's say, it's got to be Sexton.
Who starts out half for Ireland in the Six Nations?
If everybody's fit.
Definitely Sexton.
If everybody's fit, yeah.
The Daily Telegraph is more on Johnson there. And yeah, actually, it's kind of really the British.
We haven't bothered to get the sports section of that one. What's happened here?
Hard work starts for Desi in the Mer. Farrell gets the job, delivering six in a row, and that is his task. Everton must forget super coaches and give the job to Ferguson. Big dunk, obviously, going into the Man United game at the weekend. Lots of football in the Mer. Cops, minor miracle, and Minamino going to Anfield.
And then the Irish Daily Mail, which is the last one for me. Pep's secret release clause is the story here from Mike Keegan. Boss could leave at the end of the season with City Chiefs big admirers of Pochettino. I'm sure, why wouldn't they be? So that's the story there. And favourite Farrell is the choice for Dublin. Philip Lanigan here, our reflections on Desi Farrell's appointment on a 3-year term as the new Dubs boss.
There we are. I think I should have mentioned as well, on the back of the Times, obviously, Mason Greenwood, 18, one of these exciting young players coming through. And it's great to see in this age that Manchester United have these young talents coming through, like Rashford, who basically was born in Manchester, becoming a bit of a star as well. It's actually, sport is weird. Like, Manchester United looked rubbish about 3 weeks ago, and now the stars seem to be aligning, where they've got this very, very fast attacking kind of talent, and they've a pretty easy run of games coming up as well. I think their next six games, Solskjaer could be in a position to keep the job for a while.
I was a piece on The Athletic yesterday which said that I'm not actually, and I really feel bad about that every time it comes up because I really want to.
You're going to admit to reading a piece but not being a subscriber?
No, I didn't read the piece. So
okay,
I just saw the headline. But I really want to do that, by the way. But
to subscribe?
So, yeah, definitely, 100%.
It's not that difficult.
I feel bad about spending the £3 or whatever it is because I'm not sure I get the value out of it. And I know that's a poor reflection on me than it is on The Athletic. But the point being that an article yesterday where the stat that was dragged up, which is one of the most impressive stats that I've ever seen, that there's a record dating back to, and I might be incorrect on the year, but I think 1921, that 4,000 games running, Manchester United have had a player from the youth team involved in the senior team.
That's fantastic. That's as of 4,000 games running.
Clayton Blackmore saved it in 1992, Tommy tells me. He's obviously read the piece. The one question that I had off the back of it was, how do they even know that?
I know. Coventry, you haven't read the piece, as being pointed out.
How do they know it, though?
My friend's a Coventry City fan, and they've gotten like accolades for bringing more players through their youth system than any club, I think, in the four divisions. And I'm a Galway United fan. I love the fact that we've just signed Mikey Place from Dunmore. We've players from various parts of Galway, from the city, from... We've had players recent years from Glenamaddy, from the West, players from nearby counties that genuinely have some affection for Galway. I don't see the point in supporting a football team that doesn't even have players from your own country, not to mind your own area. Like, why is that football team mean anything to you anymore?
Well, that's ridiculous now.
No.
To be saying that you wouldn't support a team because they didn't have a player that wasn't from your own country. They had a player that wasn't from your own country.
So, no, if Galway United had 11 non-Irish players playing for Galway United...
Well, I mean, whatever about 11, but...
11 non-Irish players and were owned by a non-Irishman who was kind of just there as...
And this is also not, like, by the way, this is not new news either, like, in terms of the makeup of football teams. Like, as somebody who would have been at Athlone Town every week as a kid...
Really? Oh, yeah, St. Mel's?
Yeah.
You emerged alive.
Mel's is
an interesting. But, is it still there?
No, the area is still there, but the pitch has obviously moved out to Lizzie Wood.
But is the Mel's pitch gone now?
No, it's well gone, I think.
Okay. But anyway, yeah.
But the point being that, like, as a kid, There were some, but there were fewer, far fewer Athlone voices on the pitch than there were Dublin voices.
Yeah.
Like, it was the first real exposure I would have had to the Dublin accent was various players on the pitch roaring over and back at each other. Like,
yeah,
that wasn't an indictment of the talent in Athlone. It wasn't.
It was. You didn't have enough good players playing the team.
This was in a team that was an ambitious team who were at that time winning a lot of trophies. Like, were a very successful team. And it was an indictment of the fact that they wanted to continue to be successful. So the options were, fill the team with Athlone players and just accept that you're going to, whatever modicum of success is going to come your way, and that's it. Or actually stack it up, as all the better teams do, with the best players you can get.
Yeah, I still find...
Surely you're not worried if a player who plays for Galway is from Dublin or Paris?
I'd prefer Paris, actually. We haven't had many exotic signings, but to make a long story short, I am very encouraged that we've so many good local players, and I think it means a lot more if you develop players like Rashford than just buying lads from Brazil, because, like, ultimately, that's the guy that I could have, like, been, you know, I could have been gone to school with, or he's had a similar upbringing to me, and this is my local area, this is my local club, it means something since I was a kid. Like, when you bring in all these foreign players, I think clubs should definitely be encouraged to use their own youth players, because otherwise, what's your identity with the club anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I get some of that.
I get what you're saying about Athlone as well. If the players weren't good enough, what are you going to do? Yeah. But it should be all about encouraging and promoting your local players, I think.
I think that
that's why we love the GAA, because, you know, the Westmeath lad is from Westmeath.
Yeah.
You know, and like the Galway lads who won in 98 and the county was brought to a standstill, they were our neighbours.
Sound like a Britain for Britain type.
Vote Boris.
Yeah. You're not challenging that point, which I'll take as an acceptance. By the way, that stat was cropped up in 2013, apparently, when this guy did a meticulous piece of research for his book, Sons of United, and that stat emerged. So it's valid. My scepticism is misfounded, it turns out. Right, it's on 8 o'clock on this Friday morning. We have lots coming your way. You're watching OTB AM. It's the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. Plenty coming up over the course of the next hour. We're going to talk Desi Farrell with Kieran Cunningham, rugby with Alan Quinlan, but we're back talking football after these with Kenny Cunningham. OTB AM. Friday morning, delighted to say Kenny Cunningham joins us on the line. Morning, Kenny.
Morning, lads.
Kenny, what's going on over there? What's happening?
Oh, it's miserable. It's lashing.
We're not on about the weather, Kenny. Come home.
Lashing politically?
Well, it's not lashing over there.
Politically?
I'm not going to fall for that one.
Desi Farrell's appointment, before we get into the football. Kenny, a guy that we've spoken to you about before, that to you would have played on the same team, if I'm right, back the years.
Yeah, no, I'm delighted for Desi. I've kept in touch with Desi on and off and spoke to him earlier in the year. He'd taken on the senior position at NFA in it, and he was really enjoying that, and popped up the same, and he looked very much at ease working amongst the group. It was a good relationship between him and the players. Clearly he's got a bit of experience working around the Dublin setup as well, so seems like a kind of a natural choice for me. Big shoots to fill, obviously, but I think Des is kind of big enough personality, and his knowledge of the game is up there, and I think there's been a natural, healthy respect from the players as well, a broad spectrum of players. So yeah, it seems a good appointment. I wish him well.
What was that you were in looking at when he was involved with one of the underage teams? Was it?
No, it popped up. No, it's just somewhere in the season. I went up to see the lads train just to catch up with them. Just watch the lads train. Funny enough, Bohemians were training on the pitch. To my left, so I was down. My eyes were down between the Bohemian session and the Dafina boys. The Dublin contingent went there with them at the time, as he was taking the session. So yeah, it was just to see, good to see him working with the players, and spent a little bit of time with him and the players afterwards, kind of a debrief upstairs. And yeah, it was very interesting, actually. Very interesting to see him work, his kind of relationship with the players, how we spoke to the players, and his thoughts about the game, and even in terms of, like, the players themselves, he kind of gave a lot of responsibility to the players, and there was clearly a healthy respect between him and the group, so I'm sure that'll transfer to the Dublin senior setup as well.
Yeah, that sounds like it might be like one of the biggest questions is about what sort of the template that Jim Gavin had in place and so what comes next. But certainly in terms of that devolvement of responsibility, it sounds like from what you're saying, Desi is very much of that mould as well, that actually they're the ones that are important and let them make the decisions almost.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Even the short period of time I was there, you got a very much got a sense of that. No ego involved with Desi, prepared to take a big step back and allow the players to have those conversations amongst themselves and be decision makers themselves. So that was a very interesting dynamic to see at work, something which I never really experienced as a player, certainly in my early years. It was pretty much my way or the highway. And that kind of, you know, manager in terms of manager and players, and, you know, players often ridicule maybe if they spoke up in meetings and things like that and kind of sniggered at amongst the players. And, you know, if you spoke up too much, you know, you might maybe got a reputation for yourself as, oh, here he goes again, he's another opinion, he won't shut up. Where, totally the opposite.
Yeah.
The experience with early in the season. It's a good thing to see. Yeah, I think it's a very healthy environment to have.
Yeah,
clearly it's been there. It's been around the Dublin setup, not just the Dublin setup, but I imagine all around the country, different county levels. Like, but I think it's the right way forward, not just in Gal, obviously, but in any kind of elite sport, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens over the next few years. Kenny, want to get into the Premier League with you now? Obviously, all gets underway tomorrow, 12:30. Liverpool against Watford at Anfield. And it's obviously, any game that Liverpool are involved in now is going to be one of the most interesting of the weekend. 8 points clear at the top of the table. Kenny sauntered, obviously, through the Champions League to win their group. But yet there are still plenty who are unconvinced about this Liverpool team that, you know, it's only a case of whether it comes crumbling down. What's the truth about that Liverpool team? Are they going to win the Premier League by 20 points? Are they going to crawl over the line, or are they actually going to get caught?
I don't think they'd be caught. I thought they'd win at the start of the season, so clearly I haven't changed my mind. And I think there's an argument. The argument is coming stronger that they'll put probably possibly more distance between themselves and the chasing pack rather than potentially Manchester City reeling them in, although I think there is an argument there for saying potentially Leicester could be their biggest challenges. But yeah, I take your point in terms of overall the performance of the Liverpool team since the start of the season has been quite at a par to what we saw, how they finished certainly last season. But for me, that's one of their strengths, the fact that they've been able to keep this run of games together, the fact that they collectively they haven't been performing at their highest level defensively. It just hasn't been quite right. Individual performances have dipped around the pitch. But you know what, Adrian, like I've said before, it doesn't matter. Because the collective strength, the kind of mental strength of this team, like it's absolutely powerful. And for me, it's what's going to see them through. They're just so focused. You know, they're just relentless. It's as simple as that. I don't think they just won the loudest title to... It's almost like an inner will, a collective will amongst the players. That, do you know what? The quality of the performance really doesn't matter. We're going to win every game by hook or by crook, or certainly get enough points to win this league title. I think the hunger's been there for a while. It was there last season. I thought they'd do it last season. They were pipped. Credit to Manchester City for that. And I think they'll beat themselves up a little bit in terms of points they frittered away second half of the season. But I don't think I'd make that mistake again. For me, it's Liverpool's title. And probably the argument really is how much they're going to win it by rather than will they.
Where does that come from, actually, Kenny? You're on about that. They have that. They have an incredible capacity to win games, and you can see that they're... Is it coming from the fact that, I suppose, between them, they have very few Premier League medals between them, this team, and they have this massive ambition to win a Premier League medal, and probably augmented by the fact that it's been such a long search for Liverpool, 3 decades or whatever it is, that they haven't done it. But what's driving them? Because it's not all that apparent in Man City at the moment, where when City fell behind against Manchester United, you never really felt like they were going to come back and win the game.
Yeah. No, you're right, John. That's a good point. And it's an obvious thing to say. Like, I mean, look at that. People say Liverpool want it more this year. And, of course, that's to a certain extent a ridiculous thing to say. But I think there's a hidden truth in there. And that relates to what you're saying, Johnny. Manchester City serial winners in that dressing room, back-to-back titles. Do they want to win it a third time? Of course they do. Is it that real kind of desperation, that kind of manic desire to go and win it for a third time, as opposed to those Liverpool players, that mentality to win it for the fourth time and not having those kind of winners' medals around, scattered around the dressing room, as you've alluded to there? I don't quite think it is. That can be almost, John, I think, at a subconscious level, as opposed to Manchester City players turning up and thinking, you know what, lads, let it go this year. We'll come back in next year. So I don't think it's a conscious decision. But it's almost like it must be a little subconscious drop-off. Because the body language of those Liverpool players, you can't... It's staring at you in the TV screens. And when you see them being interviewed after, their body language on the pitch, you know, how they're communicating with each other on the pitch, their interviews after the pitch, the folk. You can see it, the hunger, it's there, that kind of desperation. That league title is what they want. They're good enough now. The squad's good enough. It's better than it was last year without making too many signings. It's been driven by the manager himself, very charismatic figure. You're asking me what are the reasons. I think he's a big reason. But the players themselves, the hunger's there, the quality's there. They just want it so desperate. And it's, for me, it's there on the play. I don't think they're going to give it up this season.
Are they better without Fabinho, Kenny?
Yeah. You're trying to steer me up. You want that one go away, do you? No.
I was throwing
at me a couple of weeks ago. Big loss for Fabinho. I said I don't think there'll be any loss at all. Not because I'm talking down Fabinho. He's a very good player, but I just think Henderson sliding in. They didn't do initially. He let Henderson out at Everton last week, but the last couple of games, two clean sheets, Adrian Henderson in there, kind of holding midfield role. No drop-off whatsoever, and I didn't expect it to be. In fact, Henderson dropping in there gives the opportunity to introduce Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain a little bit higher up the pitch in those advanced number eight positions. So that's the beauty of Liverpool, the strength of the squad that I'm talking about, particularly those central midfield areas now. You've got some good, really good options in there at Klopp. Keita looked to hitting a little bit of form there. Oxlade-Chamberlain getting that match fitness back where he's shown the quality, which is why Klopp brought him to the team. And that's what I'm talking about. This Liverpool team's getting better and better, even with the existing squad of players. They're actually improving year in, year out.
Yeah,
what's interesting is that if you coldly analyse the good teams they've played this season, they haven't been convincing. So the two games against Napoli, they were pretty poor. They got one goal in the two games and 1 point, and Napoli wouldn't be that strong. They weren't great at Old Trafford, kind of limped a bit to a draw. They were fortunate enough to win at Stamford Bridge. They got a late winner against Leicester. So you could kind of make, like, in terms of the Champions League.
Are you trying to make my argument for me here, Jonathan?
Well, it's like, Kenny, I don't think they've been amazing, but they have a capacity to win these routine games fairly routinely.
Which could mean they're one of the greatest teams of all time, or it could mean that they're actually just close to falling apart.
I don't think they're close to falling apart, but it's how good are this Liverpool team? If Liverpool came up against a proper team in Europe, I mean, Liverpool are still not favourites to win the Champions League, despite the fact they're so far ahead of Man City, and it'll be interesting to see when they are challenged. Even if Liverpool played the Manchester United we've seen over the last week, this weekend, I would fancy Manchester United to give them a right rattle. But Kenny, are they kind of going to peak further on in the season, or can they get better? Because, I mean, even if you look at Salah's had a 5 or 6 out of 10 season, really. So there are, you know, you could say there are improvement there, but I don't know the answer, being honest with you.
No, I think there is improvement there, John. You're absolutely right. And like I said, I think if they tap into that, then the argument and those performance, the collective level improves and the arrival level where they were second half of last season, then you are talking about them winning the title from between 10 and 20 points. It's as simple as that. So that's the beauty from a Liverpool's perspective. Looking at that, the leader they have at the moment, saying, you know, we haven't been at our very best. There's more to come. I mean, that would give you a huge sense of encouragement. And you speak about kind of the small little frailties there, little drop-offs in terms of individual performance, that, you know, cohesion maybe hasn't quite been there, too many goals conceded, etc. And, of course, I agree with all of that. But having been in the dressing room, like, obviously not in the dressing room playing the level of Liverpool's performance, when you're in a run of form and you're not playing your very best, but you keep churning out results, even that gives confidence to the dressing room, John. That gives it that belief that something's happening here, this is going to be our year. You know what I mean? We're not playing at our best, but we're still relentless. We're just picking up points and just continually, you know, just ticking boxes, like moving on to the next game. The belief, the self-confidence amongst those players, you won't be saying it publicly, but in isolation, within the confines of the dressing room, they must be looking at each other, staring each other's eyes and thinking, today, yeah, you know, everything, you know, it's all coming together, like planetary alignment, wherever it is, it's going to happen because of the circumstances you're talking about.
And it's top versus bottom as well, of course, in that one. Nigel Pearson probably have to wait for the Pearson bounce. I'm sure he might have to wait until game two for that. Leicester Norwich, just to touch on briefly, Kenny, like Brendan Rodgers obviously has signed this monster deal. You assume that he's done that. I mean, given their position in the league, that he believes that this top four stuff is sort of our pushing for the title is eminently repeatable sort of year on year. I mean, it might be that, or it might be the fact that he's sort of guaranteed himself a massive payday. I guess the question is for that Leicester City team as to whether that's actually the case, or they're punching way above their weight at the minute, and actually life is more realistic in a sort of 6-8 position for Leicester.
Yeah, well, first of all, look, I don't believe in punching above your weight. You've probably worked with me long enough, Adrian, to know that I don't believe in the theory. You can only play to your maximum. That's what Leicester are doing, have been, certainly for the last month to 6 weeks out. I think they were a little bit off towards the start of the season. He was kind of searching for the formula. Winning formula, Rodgers, he shifted Maddison out to the left wing for a couple of the high-profile games. I think it upset the balance of the team. But when he's gone back to his tried and tested, predominantly Maddison and Tielemans in those two advanced number eight positions. Spoke about Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain maybe going forward for Liverpool. Well, Maddison and Tielemans are as probably as good as they are at the moment in those positions with Ndidi in behind. Now, we flipped to a dime in the last couple of games. Accommodate Iheanacho, but Maddison playing at the tip of that kind of diamond, the strength down the spine of the team. They've been great to watch. And you're right, he's no fool, Rodgers. He knew what he was taking on. We took on that group of players. Excellent balance of the team, top quality, and a young and improving squad, which was only going to get better and better. But I think, lad, it's a window of opportunity for Leicester this year. I don't think it'll be as easy next year. The likes of Manchester United, Chelsea, I think it'll be a far healthier state. Yeah. Potentially even Arsenal with a new manager. So I think there's a real window opportunity from this year. I've always felt that even from the start of the season to grab a Champions League spot and move on. And I think Rodgers, as much as he's saying all the right things, he's a very good PR man. He's done a great job there as well. But I think secretly, this Leicester job, he's loving at the moment. Profile has gone through the roof. But for me, secretly, deep down, he's still thinking stepping stone.
Yeah, a great PR man, Kenny, is the line I'm taking out of that.
Well, he did a bit of a dig there. His comments before when he was linked with the Arsenal job were very, very astute. He said, you know, Leicester is 100% my focus at the moment. And it was kind of like, well, why are you saying at the moment? So he left a little bit.
That's a few days later, he got his five-year deal.
He knew that he was in a very strong negotiation.
He'd be entitled to be considered for those roles now.
Absolutely.
Speaking of Arsenal and City, Kenny, like, I mean, two basket cases, a club to a degree that obviously meet on Sunday at 4:30, one of the live games on Off the Ball. I don't know where to start with this one. Like, what's the... For both of these clubs this season, I see, like, even City... this morning, Pep's secret release clause, one of the stories this morning that, you know, City Chiefs big admirers of Pochettino. Like, it's, I don't know where it's all gone wrong for City this season.
No, well, I think there's reasons why it's gone wrong. Probably haven't got the time to go into it now, but yeah, it has unravelled a little bit, but I think there are reasons for that. But I'd still make them strong favourites for this game at the weekend. I wouldn't club them both get in terms of basket cases, both of these clubs. I make City strong favourites. I wouldn't get too carried away. I watched the Marseille performance West Ham a few days ago, and up until they got that first goal, Adrian, it was pretty awful stuff. It really was. And it was just the fact that really West Ham imploded after they got the equalising goal, that they ran out comfortable winners. But those kind of inherent weaknesses in the Arsenal team are still there. Don't be fooled by that result against West Ham. Yes, they get a little bit of confidence from the game, but if Manchester City go down there with the right attitude, I'm sure they will, and get the better players on the pitch. I still expect Manchester City to roll over Arsenal, despite those a couple of deficiencies that they have around the pitch at the moment, Manchester City.
Yeah. All right, Kenny, thanks a million.
No problem, lads.
Speak to you soon. Kenny Cunningham on the line there, previewing the weekend's football. And as I mentioned, that Arsenal City game is live and Off the Ball on Sunday from 4:30 in the company of Nathan Murphy and Gary Breen. And Stephen Doyle and Brian Kerr are going to take you through the early game. 2:00, Manchester United up against Big Duncan's Everton.
Big Dunk.
So we'll see how that goes. Ancelotti linked with Everton, actually, one of the papers this morning. So,
yeah, will he take that job? Maybe he would at the moment. I think he's 60 now.
Yeah, might do.
Chance back.
He's a guy that I'd like to see him around the Premier League.
Yeah.
We pay a lot of attention to. He's an interesting guy.
I love Italian football men in general, just the way. And as I only saw Napoli twice this year against Liverpool, but they were really, really set up. Yeah. They stopped Liverpool playing, really, didn't. Liverpool had very few chances in both games.
Yeah, that's right.
The problem was, obviously, there were issues off the pitch in Naples or whatever, but Gattuso's gone in to get that job, who's another really intriguing character. And Ancelotti would definitely fancy a crack at England. And maybe if Everton is his best opportunity, it's still a relatively big club. Mm. Maybe it would be great to see him back in the game here. But on Arsenal, I mean, Arsenal should be all over trying to get Rafa Benitez. Mm. I know he's doing his project in China, but I'm sure he's available. I don't know what that club is about. I don't know what they think they are. They think they should be amazing league footballers to watch, or why not bring in a proven manager and target the top four? If Benitez came in, Arsenal could easily finish top four, I think.
Question of the decade right there, Johnny. What are Arsenal about?
I don't know. They're the type of club who, I don't know, they've become increasingly epitomised by, at the start of the second half, there are a load of empty seats.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Sunday Papers also on Off the Ball this weekend. Colm Keyes of the Irish Independent, Sunday Independent, alongside sports writer Kieran O'Rahilig. So that's coming your way on Sunday as well on Off the Ball. So that's where we're going to leave that for the minute. The incoming Dublin County Board Chairman, Michael Seavers, by the way. We're going to talk Desi's Dubs, obviously, in just a couple of moments' time. But Michael Seavers, the incoming Dublin County Board Chairman, spoke to Off the Ball. Shane Hannan who was the man on duty at Parnell Park last night, about the man who's replacing Jim Gavin, Desi Farrell.
I think he's going to bring an expertise that he has learned over the years in speaking to him. He speaks of the hurt and the disappointment that was there in when Tipperary beat us in the minor final, and similar to Jim Gavin for Donegal in 2014. He's learning more from defeats than he is. But he has an expertise. He has a great footballing knowledge, and he's a proud dub. He's played for us. He's managed us at minor. He's managed club teams. And I have no doubt he will continue the culture that is there at the moment of the pride in representing Dublin and its people.
Sean Shanley, the outgoing chair of the county board, tonight mentioned, half hinted, I guess, at possible continuity in terms of Desi Farrell's backroom team. Obviously, there are no names confirmed as of yet, but is that something you'd like to see, that maybe a couple of members of Jim Gavin's backroom team stay on under Desi?
We won't be imposing anything on Desi as regards his backroom team. What we speak about at the moment in the backroom team is the expertise that we make available, the likes of Brian Cullen and Daniel Davey and our medical team, James Allen and Dicey. There's huge experience there, and that's what we have to offer to Desi. We wouldn't be a county board that will be sent to Desi. We need to vet who your backroom team as regards the footballing side of it. We won't be getting involved in that. We trust Desi to be well capable of managing that himself.
Yeah, that was, I mean, you couldn't see him, but Shane Hannan was doing the interviewing there last night down at Burnham Park. There was somebody there. Right,
God, he's a big head, Shane Hannan.
23 minutes past 8 on this Friday morning. We're going to continue our chat of the Dubs and about Desi Farrell. I'm delighted to say that the sports writer with the Irish Daily Star, Kieran Cunningham, joins us on the line. Morning to you, Kieran.
Morning, Adrian. Modern Johnny.
Exciting times. You're buzzing about this, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a strange one. Like, I was at the meeting last night, and it's a strange one for me because I actually know Desi since he was a kid. Desi's mother's from where I'm from in Donegal, and I remember we used to go training with the local GA club, and there would be this little blonde Dublin kid who used to chase after the ball when it would go behind the post and bring it back to us. And we used to be laughing at him running after the ball. And little did we know, we weren't fit to lace his boots, that this was Desi Farrell. And I've got to know him a lot. I actually bump into Desi more in Donegal than I ever have in Dublin. And I've had some great night outs. I've been locking till 4 in the morning and sing songs. And he described it in his autobiography as his ball toll. Like, it's somewhere that means a lot to him. Mm. Like, it's well documented a bit now that he's a first cousin of Seamus Coleman. He's a very strong ties up there, and I think he's a man Dublin need now. But I'm a bit conflicted on it, Adrian. Is it the best job in Gaelic football now, or is it the worst? You know, because you can make an argument for both.
Yeah, I think it's the best, isn't it? Like, I mean, when you consider the group of players, I mean, I understand the point, and it's a point well made, but when you consider the group of players that he has, Kieran, that, and the point being made across a lot of the papers, including your own this morning, that, like, he's also, this is not a dressing room that Desi Farrell needs to walk into and introduce himself. He's actually, at least in part, responsible for the development of a lot of these star players now for Dublin.
Yeah, like there are 15 of them that have won either minor or All-Ireland under-21 titles under Desi. He was also Stephen Cluxton's captain when Stephen Cluxton first came into the squad, and he's a club mate of Johnny Cooper. So that's 17 of the squad that, you know, he would have a fairly strong relationships with, and I'm sure he knows quite a few of the others quite well as well. But the only thing is, expectations are so high now. Like, it's not that long since a Leinster title mattered to Dublin, or winning a league, or getting to an All-Ireland semi-final. Now you literally have to win the All-Ireland every year. It's no good. If they don't win next year, the pressure kicks in straight away, particularly, say, if Kerry comes. Because that was the great achievement of the Gilroy and Gavin eras, that Dublin got their foot on Kerry's neck for the first time in nearly 40 years. And if that turns around, which it could, because Kerry were very, very close to Dublin this year in the first game, that would put pressure on Desi. But Desi is very competent in his professional life and his sporting life. He's been excellent. You know, he's been very successful in anything he's turned his hand to. And a lot of it depends on the backroom team. Yeah. Like, Jason Sherlock coached the Dublin forwards. By all accounts, he was brilliant. Declan Darcy coached the Dublin backs, did a great job with them. So in many ways, the manager's like a CEO in a way. Like, a lot of it is about delegation. And you see that with different counties. I know a lot of successful managers in GA, they don't do that much hands-on coaching. A lot of it is that they're putting the right people in charge and overseeing what they do. So there'll be a lot of interest now in his backroom team. I would say Mick Galvin will be part of it. He's been very close to Mick Galvin over the years.
Yeah.
Somebody who he played with in the 1995 All-Ireland winning team. I presume Brian Cotton will still be in charge of conditioning because he's a full-time employee. But I doubt if Declan Darcy and Jason Sherlock will stay on, because I got the impression they were going to go with Jim Gavin. So it'll be very interesting who he brings in.
The Cluxton question that you bring up there is an interesting one as well, and you've mentioned that relationship too. Like, you almost see no scenario where, like, if Cluxton had sort of decided over the last number of weeks or before that actually he was stepping away, like, Desi is going to make it his number one business, you assume, to sit down with Stephen Cluxton and say, listen, I need you to give me 12 months and let's go and do this. And I could see, like, Desi's obviously got a very strong track record of being a very persuasive person. Like, I could easily see how Stephen Cluxton, regardless of his whatever his decision has been over the last number of weeks, would be persuaded to stay on by Desi.
Yeah, and a lot could depend on Stephen Cluxton's body. Now, he actually gave an interview when he got the All-Star, the Footballer of the Year award, and it was the most open interview by a mile he's ever done. And he talked about the injury issues he had this summer, and it was semi-miraculous that he managed to play after the injuries he got against in the Longford game, that he managed to come back from that. And Evan Comerford played some games this year, both in league and championship. And it was remarkable how good his kicking was. And it shows the work that's been put into him, the ability he has himself, and what he's learned from Stephen Cluxton. And I think he will be a very good goalkeeper for Dublin down the line. But just when there's a transition here, even for 1 year, if Stephen Cluxton committed, I think it would be a great help. Oh. He is 38 next week. And, you know, there was that the way he did the lap of honour after the five in a row was unusual on his own, and it did seem like he was waving goodbye. But I would be pretty confident that Desi's priority now is just to get him to commit, even for 1 year, yeah, as captain as well and as leader, because even though there were fringe players over the last little while, like the likes of Bernard Brogan, Owen O'Gara, that's a lot of a couple of senior guys are gone. There's a couple other senior fellas like Michael Darragh McCauley. We don't know if they're going to commit for next year yet. So I think he would be very, very keen to keep Stephen.
Yeah, he might have been waving goodbye is what I'm saying, and Desi's charm and charisma might be reversing him back out of that. Speaking of his charm and charisma, Kieran, like, he's obviously a guy that has been very much in the public eye over the last number of decades, but actually since leaving the GPA, not somebody we've really heard that much of over the last couple of years.
Yeah, like I there's an interesting one about the GPA, actually. You know, I'll run a date by you. May 23rd, 2002, there was a press conference in the Barclay Court Hotel to announce Desi as the new CEO of the GPA. And hardly anyone turned up. Why was that?
Something going on at the time?
Saipan. It was the day of Saipan. It was Desi told me this before. He said there was one man, one dog there.
Another iconic new leader was emerging at that time.
Indeed, Johnny. But initially, he's a very bright guy, Desi. He got Student of the Year in his last year at school. But he decided, he went into psychiatric nursing, which his father had done before him. After that, he did that for a while. Then he moved into a rep selling medical supplies. Then he did an MBA, was CEO of the GPA. And the early days of the GPA were very fraught. It would have been very easy to walk away. There was a lot of hassle to deal with. And he could have walked into a handy enough number, but he stuck at it and he established it into the body that it is now. Since he stepped down from the CPA or the GPA, he set up a new zone company, which is called Compete with Compassion. .ie. It's a consultancy firm that, you know, that on their website they help clients to create a championship winning culture, and that's not what Dublin want, is to continue a championship winning culture. But he helped out with the Dublin Hurlers this year behind the scenes,
yeah,
which a lot of people
coach,
didn't know about. He helped out with Matty Kenny, not in a coaching way, but more in a consultancy way, right, like the way Gary Keegan would have worked with Dublin before with the Cork Hurlers about just creating a winning culture.
Yeah, performance coach was the expression that I had heard in relation to it. An interesting one that I hadn't clocked, I have to say.
It is informed psychologically, because, as Kieran said, is it a great job or is it a bad job? And do you kind of just, you can't ape Jim Gavin, but you have to respect what the culture that's there.
Well, so on that, like, that's an interesting one, Kieran, right? But sort of whether you continue with what's been sort of gone before in terms of the template that's been there for the development of sort of responsibility to the players and the style, because the style has been good to look at and it's been winning football, obviously. What's Desi going to do?
I think it'll be more like Dublin have always evolved. Like Dublin have never been the exact same year on year. Their style evolves all the time. They're always looking for new ways to tweak and improve. And generally, there's one or two new players every year. And there are young, you know, the young players like Kieran Archer, Padraig O'Coffey-Byrne, that will be knocking on the door next year. And they have huge strength and depth in attack. They don't have that to the same extent in defence. So I would think that would be a priority to blood a few new defenders during the league. But, you know, when you look at the wider football landscape, like Kerry are coming with what they've won at underage in the Great League Forward they made this year, reaching the league final, pushing Dublin so close in the drawn game and being in the game for a fair bit of the replay, you would expect Kerry to win All-Ireland. But you don't know now, looking around the rest, you could make a case in 1 year, if everything falls for them, that a Mayo or a Galway or Donegal or Tyrone might win an All-Ireland over the next 5 or 6 years. But you wouldn't back any of them with any confidence either. So it does look like Dublin and Kerry. And with the present structures, Dublin are more or less guaranteed to be in All-Ireland semi-finals. So from that point of view, it's a great job for Desi. But I think trying to win, get the All-Ireland this first year, like if he's there for 3 years, the only ones won All-Ireland. It will probably be seen. People think, okay, you did well, given what what had happened before. You know, you kept it going. But I think there's more pressure to win it in the first year. I think because if the cycle is broken, straight away questions will be asked, and people will be saying, could we not have persuaded Jim Gavin to stay on?
Yeah, or get him back, no doubt.
Yeah.
Kieran, thanks, William.
No problem, lads. Bye.
That'd be terrible on Desi. Like, imagine he's 1 year out the door. Bring back Jim.
Like, Jim is leaving, and like, I fully expect to see Jim Gavin back as Dublin manager someday.
Yeah.
He's still a young man, like, there's no reason.
Would you prefer to be Pádraig Joyce getting the Galway job with all that potential but very, very measured expectation, taking over from a regime that he's fairly sure he can better? Or would you want to be Desi Farrell, where basically it'll be very hard to do any better?
What's your answer to that?
Honestly, I'd prefer the Pádraig Joyce challenge because he could be an absolute, like, he's already an icon in Galway, but he could be, you know, an icon on another level entirely if he could restore the glory of Galway football. Desi can, even if Desi won two All-Irelands in a row, Ashraf, yeah.
Like, but look, here's the thing, right? Would you like to be, forgetting about the other factors, the guy who is suddenly in charge of one of the greatest groups of footballing talent of all time? A young group who are going to be around for a number of years.
That's
for
another
me,
thing.
As simple as
enough
that.
About Galway. What about Dublin?
Hey.
That's another thing. He is working with the best, and that must be enjoyable day to day.
Yeah.
Do you know, whereas he has poor choice, a lot of issues to sort out. Desi doesn't.
Only one vote that matters, as you know, Johnny. This weekend it's 8:34. Time for this.
Olympic champion. I've dreamed of this moment so many times before.
Voting is live, 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 live.
That's Katie Taylor anyway. But what are we voting on? The Lowry versus...
check out the Off the Ball social feeds. It's Johnny Sexton's drop goal against France. Shane Lowry winning the Open 2019.
It's a good one to call because, I mean, the other night it was Cluxton's kick against Kerry versus Galway's 2017 hurling win, and it was practically a split vote. A bit like the North Belfast... The North Belfast election was quite hard to call, but this one, I'm going to predict Shane Lowry will win.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, rugby has so much support in this country.
Yeah, I think Shane Lowry has more
cross
cut
sport.
Through
yeah.
than
I'm not
rugby.
Like I'm not a
That's
golf not fan, but I like Shane Lowry, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. Yeah. I think there'll be a lot of people in that category. There's about 50 votes in, it's just been launched, and already Shane Lowry is sort of...
50 votes. And I find if you put up a poll on Twitter, like, literally the first 30 votes will be the very, very similar to 1,200.
Yeah.
Because that's, yeah, and that's why once that exit poll came out last night, people had already said, well, that's how it is.
The exit polls are in, and Shane Lowry's going to win this thing. We're actually going to speak with his coach a little bit later on, Neil Manship, to have some reflections on what it was a bloody amazing summer for Shane Lowry and events at the Open, obviously, as well. So we'll get his thoughts on that a little bit later on. We're going to talk rugby in a few minutes' time. Alan Quinlan's going to join us to look ahead to the weekend, the Heineken Cup. But we are, first of all, reflecting on our Heineken Roadshow from the Gal Montatel in Galway. During the week, Will Greenwood was one of our star names on the guest list on the night. He spoke about roommates at one point in their career himself, as Lions, of course, himself and Brian O'Driscoll. Says he wasn't the worst teammate that he had to share space with.
What I didn't realise was he's the scruffiest bastard I've ever... God, literally, I've always joked about it. That I used to go back to my room and think we'd been burgled. Didn't really do hygiene and tidiness. It wasn't your thing then. Then
I was young.
Yeah. Yeah. What does that mean, that you can be smelly and dirty?
I don't know, but was smel-
no, not smelly.
Smelly, as
smelly
well.
Is a bit excessive, but it was. You wouldn't say you put anything away.
No.
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 You weren't as bad as
but
Rob
there was
Henderson.
No, there was no point in putting anything away when you're moving every 3 days. Surely just out
well,
on the floor.
We'd have
you know?
To disagree there. As a boarding school boy, that was the whole point, to be like you. Anyway, but it wasn't. Why would we argue about this? It's not important. I roomed with Rob Henderson on the same tour. Yeah, same tour. And he was, I mean, you were an angel. So Rob Henderson used to come in, because he didn't really sleep, come in from the pub about 3 o'clock in the morning and light up. Right. He'd then wait you up for a chat. He'd order room service. Right,
and he'd order you. He'd have you have a ham and cheese
sandwich.
You
and you get one as
you'll
well.
Have just one. To, on.
You have
yeah.
one. Go on. He was a feeder. He's a feeder in Rob Henderson. He then put on Channel 901 on the telly.
That right. Be, what was that? That will be right. Edited. That MTV, right?
Yeah, 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 MTV. Put that on, and then right because he knew. Honestly, we'd have a game of cribbage.
What?
Cribbage.
I never got the cribbage.
No, you never got the cribbage, yeah. And, so this extraordinary four-ball of things would happen. 3 o'clock every morning, 9:01, cigarette, room service, game of cribbage.
What is cribbage, actually?
Well, I had two questions out of that. One of them was in relation to Channel 901, that we'd probably not go any further on this time
speculate.
Of morning for a lot of different reasons. And the other one was, what the hell is cribbage?
It's kind of like a kind of a bar game, isn't it? It's got like matches and dominoes.
Okay.
More, so it's like...
Yeah, kind of a pub game, but like one you don't need like a pool table or a darts board right. for. You know, you just... You can sit and drink over it.
I am worried
you can punt
the,
on it, I'm pretty sure, as well.
I'm worried about the increasing love for the oval ball game in Galway because, you know, Galway United and is trying to, you know, get people through the gates and so forth. And footballers trying to... Hurlers trying to win back the All-Ireland.
Can I...
Rugby should be well
ask
down
the list of priorities. What prompted you to make that comment just now?
I am worried
because it was apropos of absolutely nothing we've been discussing.
No, because that was a rugby thing in Galway. It took place in
okay.
Galway during the
well,
week.
Well, Sir Farrell was at it. So
Sir Farrell was at it, but it was mainly rugby personalities. And
it was.
Rugby was never a thing in Galway when I was growing up. Anywhere like Craig's had a club, Munavee,
yeah,
so forth. Then you had to go to Buccaneers and Ballinasloe, but that was like edging towards the Midlands. But now the sports ground is a big deal, and in fairness, Connacht are good. Galway United were languishing.
You say get out of town, lads, sort of. Forget about this nonsense. Let us back to what we know best. Let us back to our own native sports, like soccer.
Soccer, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely would... I'm slightly worried about people falling away from soccer and football, as I call it, in Gaelic games, and becoming bandwagon rugby fans in Galway.
Like
yourself.
Bandwagon yeah. rugby fans.
You're the worst
really
kind
success,
of bandwagon rugby fan
the
in that
Ireland.
You're a Leinster fan.
I haven't.
Yeah, like, am I a Leinster fan? You post quite a few pictures from the audience.
You are, I think, a Leinster fan, are you?
With the Aviva tomorrow.
Are you more Leinster than you are Connacht?
I enjoy watching Leinster play. My joy in Connacht is qualified by the fact that I think they're encroaching on Galway United territory.
You're right.
In fact,
but to be fair, you think of that about everything and everybody, so they're not unique. But
that arts festival.
It's going to be a good year for Galway United, though. That's my parting glass.
Good.
Okay.
Desi.
Let's start with Desi. Yeah, Desi Farrell is the new man in charge of the Dublin Senior Footballers. The Na Fianna clubman was last night handed a 3-year term to succeed Jim Gavin. Of course, Farrell's previously led Dublin to All-Ireland success at minor and under 21 levels. His backroom team yet to be announced. That will come in due course, which he said he will make known before the team go on their holiday. Meanwhile, Dublin GAA continue to be in rude financial health. The 2019 financial statement showed a significant rise in commercial and sponsorship revenue. Michael Sievers, the new chairman, chats to Shane Hannan about some of those gains at Parnell Park last night.
It's the commodity that we can provide. It's how humble the guys were, and the product that we have is a first-class product and people want to be associated with it, and we can't be faulted for that.
And what are the challenges you think you face in your position now? Obviously, Dublin is in a remarkably healthy position as you enter this county board chairmanship. What are the challenges you foresee over the next number of years that you face?
We need to get land. We need pitches for clubs. the rise of ladies football and camogie, and the increase in huge increase in the number of juveniles playing our games. We're going to continue to push that to get that in. But we've got to get pitches, we've got to get grass, and that will be the big challenge for us.
You want to see his head there, but that was Shane Hannon in conversation with Mr. Seavers last night.
Absolutely. Mr. Seavers talking about the product and the commodity. You know, this is Gaelic football. It's
fair enough. Really, look at their financial. The look at their financial.
Yeah, it's kind
of. Look at their financials, Johnny.
This is for another day, but the how big the inter-county scene has become at the cost of 99% of the players, which are club players, is a bit of a disgrace, really.
What I would say is a disgrace is if the example that Dublin are now giving, and you only have to take one very quick glance at the financial report that they sent through last night to see the level of numbers that we're dealing with. What is a disgrace is that other counties aren't looking at that and treating their own county like a commodity and treating it in that way. That would be what I would think is a disgrace, right? Because there's an unbelievable opportunity. They've proven there's an unbelievable opportunity, even in terms of the scale. It was close to a million extra commercial revenue from the previous 12 months.
Like, commercial revenue about this amateur sport.
Well, look at what, like, if it's there to be, if there's money to be brought in to pour back into the development of the games, why would you not do it?
I know, no, I agree. But I do stand to that argument that, like, it is costing the club scene, like, in terms of fixture lists, in terms of players showing up for their clubs, it's costing them, because the county thing should be representative level, not.
But that's not just those financial, that commodity aspect is to do with everything. That's county, the whole.
Yeah, but yeah, Dublin are, a million is a lot. Like, that's a lot of money
on top. It's the extra.
We could do with it in Galway. Do it in the FAI.
Galway United.
Let's get to the FAI.
Well, I'm going to the FAI. They're up next because
Here's a million. Oh no, we need an awful.
Do you have another 80 of them? Onto our favourite sport, administration. The FAI, the last member of the FAI board who served under former chief executive John Delaney, stepped down last night. In a post on social media late last night, the FAI announced John Early had resigned with immediate effect. It said that Mr. Early had tendered his resignation, having made the decision in the best interests of Irish football. Elsewhere, actually, on the pitch last night, all five British sides will be in Monday's draw for the last 32 of the Europa League. Arsenal won Group F after going from 2-0 down to draw 2-0 away to Standard Liège. Diogo Jota hat-trick helped Wolves beat Besiktas 4-0. They qualify as runners-up from Group K. The last-minute own goal saw Rangers held to a 1-1 draw by the Young Boys, but Steven Gerrard's side go through as Group G runners up. Celtic lost 2-0 away to Cluj, but they'd already topped Group E. An 18-year-old Mason Greenwood scored twice as Manchester United hammered Alkmaar by 4-0 to finish top of Group L. That made it 3 wins in a row for United, of course, following the back of those wins for Tottenham and Manchester City. But Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said there are still areas that need improving and the club could make additions in January.
We're looking to strengthen in many positions. Because if you look at our squad compared to the others, we're getting there, but we still need two or three players to have a squad with enough numbers and to rotate throughout a long season.
Ollie's going to be fine, isn't he? It's just all of a sudden it looks like he's fallen on a system that... The game against Everton is fascinating for me. It's probably the most interesting game of the entire weekend. If Everton have to play a conservative game plan, they can't really go there and go gung-ho. Big Dunk, you know. So how this Man United team reacts to a team that parks the bus to a little degree will be very, very interesting, I think.
Yep, Manchester City, meanwhile, their boss Pep Guardiola has got a break clause in his contract. It's been reported today. It could see him leave at the end of the season. The Catalan coach currently contracted until 2021, but should Guardiola decide to leave and certain conditions by City are met, the coach will be able to terminate his employment 12 months in advance. Quick word about rugby. Ulster head to the Twickenham Stoop this evening looking to protect top spot in pools. Three of the Heineken Champions Cup. Of course, they've won their first three games, including beating tonight's opponents by a point last week. Meanwhile, there's action in Munster's pool tonight, where Racing play host to Ospreys. Both those games getting underway at 7:45, and Munster, Leinster and Connacht will announce their teams today. Well, in darts, County Down's Kevin Burness will get the PDC World Darts Championship underway tonight. He faces former BDO champion Jelle Klassen in the first match at the Hockey, and a match against defending champion Michael Van Gerwen awaits the winner.
Tom, thanks a million for that. Just before we get to the rugby, I want to point you towards an article on offtheball.com this morning, just gone up in the last few minutes. Cian Fahey writing our latest American football piece on our brand new American football section. Do head up there and check it out. It's a bit of an ode to Lamar Jackson. You can get that from the headline there. And Keane writes, Lamar Jackson entered the Baltimore Ravens game against the Jets last night as the MVP-elect. He leaves it in position to be voted unanimously as nobody is even close to him this season. So you can read all about that. Check it out. It's up on offtheball.com. England's Alan Quinlan in studio next to preview the weekend of Heineken Champions Cup. But England's World Cup hero in 2003, Will Greenwood, shared an insight last night, and alongside Brian O'Driscoll, shared an insight into Johnny Wilkinson's curious brand of competitiveness.
When we were in Japan, we were doing a promotional day, and we were sitting in the car on the way there, and we started talking about
lifting
weights and what if
Romanian single leg Romanian deadlift.
Correct.
Yes.
If you were to pick up one exercise, what would you do? And I picked a single leg RDL. Don't ask.
Okay.
But yours was
lat pull downs.
Lat pull downs. But Johnny just was like, pretty much anything that's endurance.
Yeah.
Just don't tell me. I'll just keep going. And he started telling a story, and I'm not talking out of turn here by saying it. It kind of started where he'd be up in Newcastle, and he was at, period of time after being injured in the World Cup in 2003. And he'd go to the games on a Friday night, and then he'd hide in the gym before the match would start because he wouldn't want to be talking to people, quite an introvert. And he'd be in the gym in his suit and tie, and be like, might just do a little something, and he'd start lifting a few weights, and he said it's like that danger weights where you put on too much and you're wondering whether you can actually lift. And I was like, oh, I got that one, I think I've another one in me, and he'd just keep on banging them out. And then he'd be like, I'll get on the rower here now, in his suit, rower. And I was like, do you gonna have a shower? And no, sure, you don't smell till later on, you're fine.
Right, 8:47 on this Friday morning. Alan Quinlan is with us. And how are you getting on?
Good morning. Yeah, I'm very good, Adrian.
I think it wasn't my intention, but I wasn't intending to describe you as England's Alan Quinlan in the introduction.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised by that one.
I know of all people to be heading down that route. Will Greenwood, obviously, at our Heineken Roadshow in Galway last night, was saying that Leinster could win the Six Nations.
Yeah, I think given the strength and depth and the way they're playing, I think it wouldn't be... It's not the craziest thing that anyone has ever
said. In the hypothetical conversation that we're clearly having, would they beat Ireland?
You must remember, Adrian, sometimes the provinces are much more organised and cohesive and have a togetherness and an understanding of each other quicker than the national sides have. Traditionally, the Six Nations start slowly because teams are kind of a week or two together and it takes them a little bit of time, new calling systems, all that kind of stuff, whereas you're with the province throughout the year. I know they dip in and out the internationals a lot, but that kind of continuity and selection and stuff makes a massive difference. We see so much rotation in the modern day rugby. And that's why even Dan McFarlane with Ulster, they've been winning games the last number of weeks, and because he's trying to build a bit of continuity and that momentum together. And
would they beat Ireland?
Would Leinster beat Ireland? Yeah, probably. Yeah, they would, yeah.
That's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the vast majority of them are on the Irish team anyway,
it's just hypothetical.
Yeah, but you understand what I mean about that continuity and togetherness and that working, changing a complete new calling system. I know you have the national sides have little windows and camps, but it's just you're more organised provincially, and they've so many internationals that they just have that unique strength and depth.
Leinster have the Saints, obviously, at the Aviva Saturday evening, 5:15 start there. Massive opportunity for Ross Byrne here. I know you've been crunching some of the numbers in terms of Leinster's opportunity to qualify outright with still a couple of games to go, which is an outrageous thought in itself. But Ross Byrne is a massive opportunity given that everything that's gone on around him now with Sexton's injury, Carberry's injury, Carty maybe out of a bit of form, to stake his claim now as Ireland starting out half for the Six Nations if Sexton doesn't make it back.
Yeah. I think he's probably it's a real opportunity for him in the next couple of weeks to show what he can do and maybe show the disappointment and pain and hurt that he would have had not going to the World Cup and Jack Carty kind of jumping ahead of him, if you like. And it's home comforts for him as well. He plays really, really well with Leinster. And I even found that as a player, when you come out of your provincial setup, it can affect some people. I'm not saying it's affecting him in any way, but he's probably way more confident playing in the Leinster jersey at the moment because, he's built up mileage on the clock and stuff in the last couple of years.
Matt Williams was making the point about him in the Irish Times this morning that he's lacking a small bit of arrogance, I think was the word, that, like, in a positive sense, that he's a bit too nice, that actually he'd like to see him stamp his personality in games and be the guy who's back.
He's possibly right with that. I think it's that, maybe that little bit of spark as well that you want from a fly half and a bit of dominance to boss people around. He's very, very kind of laid back and relaxed in his approach, and he's very composed, very good footballer and very physical as well when he wants to be. But maybe lacking that little bit of personality and that bit of aggression to boss people around. So it is a big opportunity in the next couple of weeks for him. And because they're, you know, Joey Carberry, he'd maybe play over Christmas. I'm sure Andy Farrell would want him to be available. It depends how long Sexton is out as well. So certainly what you get from Ross Byrne is you get, I wouldn't say a safe bet, but you get a very good structured player who doesn't make a lot of mistakes. He doesn't set the world on fire. Maybe he's not a line breaker. He's not someone who's doing little ding kicks in over the top where Jack Carty does. I'd be saying to Jack Carty, you know, you need to be a bit more structured.
Yeah.
So listen, nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
I'm sure when I played, you know, anyone could say that I needed to do X, Y, and Z. We all have strengths and weaknesses, and, you know, the complete players are few and far between in any sport.
Does Sexton go into the Christmas, like, a little bit worried about 2020 now in terms of the New Zealand game, out of that? Now he's injured. He's a replacement out half, is playing very well. Is his position in Ireland absolutely secure, presuming he's fit in February?
I don't think anyone's position in Ireland is absolutely secure. I think in the next couple of weeks and over Christmas and probably into round 5 and 6 in Europe, it's Andy Farrell has to pick the foreign players, whoever they are. But look, Sexton has looked like back to his best in the last couple of weeks. He's played very well for Leinster and the World Cup. I suppose we've analysed it to death at this stage, but I think he's more frustrated, Johnny, because he would have really wanted to just try and get a good run.
And age is not his ally in that regard.
Yeah, but in fairness to him, he keeps talking the talk that he's going to keep going for as long as he can, and he doesn't seem to be waning as regards physically, you know what I mean? So,
from your perspective as an out-half, like, when you played, when is an out-half probably, on average, regressing? Or, like, can you play well into your mid-30s?
We're all regressing once we hit over that 30 mark, and it's people start scrutinising you more, and if you have a bad game, they put it down to age. I never agreed with that, because I genuinely played some of my best rugby in my whole career when I was 34, 35. So, you know, I'm a backer and a believer of someone if they're fit enough, if they're good, you know, if they're in good shape and they mind themselves well. When you get that bit older in any sport, you have to watch the diet, the alcohol consumption, the amount you train, the individual stuff you do. And obviously it's up here how much desire and passion is there to do it. Sometimes you're pressing numbers and you're pushing your body that maybe you just can't do, you know what I mean?
Would Farrell, do you think, like, briefly, would he be the type of guy to make a stance here and I'm going to be ruthless and make some very hard-based calls here to kind of set my agenda?
It depends. I think there's more pressure on him to do stuff like that if he buys into what the expectation from the outside is and what the public would call for. And it's very easy for us all to be ruthless and say cut and cull and do this and that. You know,
it is by results, though.
But I do, for sure. I do believe, though, that there needs to be some injection of new blood. And then you can accept some of the older players, as long as they're playing well, that they're being reinvigorated. So it's a challenge for any manager. And it'll be the same with Desi Farrell with Dublin. How does he reinvigorate them? If he does the exact same stuff again, you know, there's always a danger that you won't progress, because the other teams always strive to get better year on year. So I think that will be the case, is try and reinvigorate the older guys who haven't played that well. And if they're fit and well enough, well, they're in contention, and bring in some young players as well.
Yeah, 5 to 9 on this Friday morning, watching OTB AM, the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. Munster very well set. Quinny, obviously, in that group, huge amount sort of riding, obviously, in this weekend. Is it fair enough to say that, given, because I've seen some of the quoting from Johan van Graan this week talking about the trajectory of that Munster group now, with the new coaches that have come in and a few little bits of switches with some of the players and stuff like that, that it's maybe not even really about this year for Munster. Is that, do they get a bit of a free pass this year, or would
they
you still be expecting?
No, I don't. Yeah. That's just the reality of where they're at. The same way as if Leinster were having a bad year, you don't get a... I think you've got to deal with pressure and expectation, and it's been unfair at times for Munster, very unfair, but, you know, I would never accept, you know, not getting out of the group and say, that's okay, we're building. You've got to try and make sure that you're in that position year on year.
Well, he's talking about stuff like, obviously, the new coaches coming in and the
yeah, of course,
and
of
also
course.
Some, like the international players coming back. It felt like a lot of building up to, well, look, that's why this year didn't quite work out.
Yeah, you can get, it's very dangerous talk to kind of go, well, it'll be next year, it'll be, you know what I mean? I don't think he's saying that, but they won't get a free pass, but they'll get, there's some mitigation there, but there is a level of frustration, I'm sure, with the players themselves that, you know, they haven't got to the final, they haven't won a trophy. Like, Munster hasn't won a trophy in 8 years, which is disappointing. There's lots of factors that tell you why that hasn't happened. There was a complete change of a group of players who were probably there for 10, 12 years, and they've been trying to build and mix it with the best in Europe, and it's being at the top table is very, very difficult. Leinster do have a, I wouldn't say an unfair advantage, but they have an advantage over the other provinces, well documented, the numbers they have coming through, but they've developed that and they've utilised that in a very, very strong way. So it's always going to be a challenge for Munster. The challenge is bringing young players through, and I've said this many times, is you can get into the scenario of saying, well, we're going to bring a lot of young players into the team and lose for a year or two and not make knockout stages of Pro 14 in Europe. Is that acceptable? It's not. It's not the right way to do it. I think you've got to try and keep building and stay. Mm. Even if you have to try and maintain that quarterfinal standard year on year. For me, that's where I'd measure the success on. If they don't get out of the group, the fact of the matter is there's two former champions in there who are powerhouses in Racing and Saracens. So when you kind of look back at the group, it was the group of death. It is the group of death.
Is it really though, like with Saracens? Will Greenwood again was making the point at the show on Wednesday night that
we'll see tomorrow what team they
pick. Well, in terms
of
the team, he was saying that he was firmly of the belief that we won't see a full Saracens team in the pool stages, and obviously on that basis we're just not going to see them at all.
Well, if you don't see a full pool a Saracens team tomorrow, Munster have a much better chance, and I think I actually think Munster will play a lot better because they're not a team that liked the conditions that were there last week. And we probably would have been accused of being a team at the start of my tenure with Munster who loved the wet, mucky conditions. And we had a really hard, grizzled forward pack who mauled the daylights out of everybody, and we kept it pretty tight. And as the years went on, the team in 2008 was much different with Tupoki and Howlett Mafi. Mm-hmm. These guys, we played a different brand of rugby. This group of players genuinely want to play rugby under Larkham, and I've seen some very positive signs of what they're trying to do. So they are like building Ross. Something. The way they're trying to play, they made 10 clean line breaks against Racing, and they weren't just mistakes from the opposition. They created a lot. The problem was they didn't finish them, and that will come back to haunt them, because I couldn't criticise them after that game because I thought they were brilliant. They played really, really well and against a very, very good Racing side, but they just didn't take the opportunities and the chances. So I think they'll play rugby tomorrow and they'll have a real go. And you have to be realist as well that, you know, if Saracens play the Vunipola brothers, Cruz, Toje, all these, Jamie George, you know, they're just so powerful, and it's going to be very difficult for any team to beat them. So we'll see on selection, but it's a monumental task for them going to Saracens. I wouldn't completely dismiss it and say they've no chance, but they have to. The reality here, Adrian, is they have to win either away in Saracens or away in Paris after Christmas against Racing.
Because and this is by going to...
Well, they're currently on 11, so,
yeah.
You know, if they didn't get Antin out of tomorrow, you're thinking two wins will put them on 20 at minimum. You know, if they won, they've got 4 points in away in Racing and then a bonus point win at home, they go to 20 points, they get out of the group. It'll complicate matters because I think you could have three teams... So if Saracens win tomorrow with a bonus point, they go to 10. They'll then fancy their chances of beating Racing. So you could easily have three teams here on 17, 18, 19 points. And
all in the mixer.
In the mix like that. So,
And I mean, the reality is even if they don't go with their first pick that, like, as we've seen, they can give any team a rattle, even with sort of a lot of the backup players that are in there. What we mentioned about Ross Byrne earlier on, how would you describe the form of Conor Murray at the minute? And is he still the first pick nine for Ireland if we were selecting a team right now?
Probably not, I think, because John Cooney is playing so well, I think, at the moment. And I think...
We could end up with a half-back pairing in the Six Nations, neither of whom went to the World Cup.
It's unlikely, though, to be honest, because I still think Conor Murray is a superb player. And I think he's a little bit laborious in his delivery at the moment. And
when was he last in peak form?
Well, he was outstanding against Scotland in the opening game in Japan. People said, "And well, Scotland were useless." We'll always go to that one, but he was outstanding that day. He has the full bag of tricks. I think he just needs to maybe he's probably trying so hard to find that form, and you can get into that position where you're trying a lot and you're trying so much and enforcing it. Where probably just I would say to him, and he'd probably tell me, having a clue what I'm talking about, it's just pass for a while and just zip the ball out there and try and get it into the runner's hands as quickly as possible. And so look, hopefully, you know, one big performance changes a lot very, very quickly. But
if you were picking a team right now, though, you were saying that he probably isn't the starting nine.
It's certainly a conversation that would come up in the selectors meetings and the coaches meeting about who they'd start. It's a big call. It's
like suddenly we're starting to get a lot of options there, is the other thing. Like you mentioned, Cooney, we've McGrath obviously flying it, we've Blade emerging
in
Gibson Park, Blade emerging in Connacht as well. Like, they're suddenly a position that not that long ago we didn't think we have that many options. Like, that's another, even outside of his own form, there, as you say, there are other players that are coming into the mix.
There are. There's a number of them playing really well. And I suppose it's, again, pretty much in the next few weeks, if John Cooney keeps doing what he's doing, if Ulster win in Quinns tonight and he's another standout performance, well, people will talk about it more and more. So Conor Murray needs to play well in the next few weeks to and in the two games in January. But sometimes your own individual form is dictated by whether your team win or not.
Yeah.
So if Munster get a big win...
But you don't think that's the case with him. With Murray, obviously, it's, I mean, not so much, because frequently the scrum half, people would say, well, the scrum half hasn't been informed because the pack aren't pushing on, but like,
there's a mixture of that, you know. They've been disjointed a little bit against Racing and against Saracens. They're doing a lot of good things, but he's still digging out a lot of ball, you know. Their breakdown hasn't been as sharp and as good as it can be, and it maybe as it should be. And you see, you know, the top teams, when they get quick breakdown, it's very hard to stop them from, and they can execute and punish you a lot. So hopefully he does play well in the next few weeks, because if he plays well, Munster play well, and they'll need him tomorrow.
Yeah, all right, we're just going to need to turn around. Just give us a word on these then, Quinny, just to wrap up on the predictions.
Good old predictions last week as well.
Jesus, the predictions.
Very confident on Leinster.
What's going to happen at Allianz Park?
I can't see Munster winning.
Right.
I'd love to say they will win. But I think they'll play well. I think they could get a losing bonus point.
Saracen's
hope I'm wrong, of course, and eat my words and Munster win.
Quinny, you're coming out of my way, I think.
Just in case people think I don't want him to win. I want him to win, for sure.
The Aviva?
I think Leinster will be much too strong. Saracens or Northampton will probably be throwing the kitchen sink at it, and they're actually a very dangerous side. If the ball sticks from them, they play a brilliant brand and move the ball around. But I just think that Leinster will just be much too strong and show again that they're the team to beat this year.
And the early one tomorrow, obviously, Connacht, Gloucester, Connacht bottom of Pool 5, lost to Kingsham last weekend.
So many things last weekend, just probably made mistakes when they get into vital areas and turned the ball over. And so I think the place will be rocking there. They have a slight chance of getting out of that group, and I'll tell you why. If they beat Gloucester tomorrow, they then have Toulouse at home in round 5. They win that one as well, and then they're away to Montpellier in round 6, who at that stage I think will be out of the competition, potentially could be out of the competition.
Right. So still in with a fighting chance of some
sort. Yeah, so they may end up going to Montpellier to get that third win, which would be fourth win, because they've beat Montpellier at home. If they beat Gloucester, Toulouse And if they were, I'd love to see him go in the last game because I think they're the type of side who throw caution to the wind and,
sort of thing,
and just throw the ball. And if they got four wins, they could get out of that group, which would be incredible.
Ulster tonight, they're obviously in the habit of now edging out sort of tight games.
Yeah, winning is a habit, isn't it? And they have that belief and confidence. They're making it difficult for themselves. And I saw one of the headlines in the Indo this morning saying that Ulster have got to stop relying on John Cooney. His last gasp penalties and or him scoring a try or his individual brilliance, they've got to probably execute more. And they were poor against Harlequins last week at times in the game and were very, very fortunate to win that game. Really fortunate. Yeah. So I think Quinns might turn them over tonight. So,
right.
Yeah.
Check. We'll take a check in your predictions again on Monday, Quinny. Thanks a million.
Cheers.
As always, Alan Quinlan ahead of the weekend of Heineken Champions Cup this weekend. Live also on Off the Ball, of course, right across the weekend. Right, you're watching Off the Ball, OTB AM, the sports breakfast show from Off the Ball. We're going to be back talking Desi Farrell, one of his former Nafina teammates, and a McNulty next. OTB AM. All right, 8 minutes past nine on this Friday morning. Delighted to have you along with us. OTB AM, the sports breakfast show from Off the Ball. Myself and Johnny with you this morning. We've been discussing a lot of Desi Farrell. Delighted to say we're joined on the line by a man who knows a lot about him. Played together in the famous Nafina team with alongside several other legends there. Desi himself, obviously. Senan Connell, Kieran McGeaney, and the McNulty brothers, of course. Epic clashes, the Dubs against Armagh. And this man also worked closely with Desi during their time at the GPA. Enda McNulty, good morning to you.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Adrian. How are you doing, Johnny?
Not too bad. I mean, Enda's, again, we can only start by asking about the election results and what this means for Northern Ireland and what this means for the whole lot of us. I mean, everything else is immaterial, really, isn't it?
Well, with Brexit results and with, obviously, Boris getting into play, I suppose it's strange times in Northern Ireland because, to a certain extent, we've been left behind and forgotten about. I know a lot of business people in the north are really, really concerned. A lot of people in education are concerned about a lack of clarity on funding and so on for primary schools or secondary schools. So a lot of my family, my friends are concerned, to say the least.
Yeah. Talk to us about Desi and what are the Dubs getting?
I'm delighted. I'm absolutely delighted for Desi. I'm delighted for Nafina. I'm delighted for his family. And yes, I'm delighted for the Dubs. What are they getting? Well, first of all, they're getting a true leader. They're getting a guy who's a natural team player. They're getting a guy who will do all in his power to get the best out of the players and the best out of, I guess, the next generation of players. They're getting an honest guy, no BS about Desi. They're getting a guy who's also fun. He knows how to balance the real straight talking in the change rooms with the fun at night and a few bottles of beer. They're getting a guy who's worked his way from being a psychological or a psychiatric nurse, apologies, up to the guy who's now the manager of the Dubs. So in terms of inspiring the young Dublin players, what they can do in their career, not even their football career, I think they're getting a really strong role model. Yeah. So my experience with Desi would be, the first time I ever encountered him was on a football pitch, Dubs against Armagh. I think it was a National League semi-final, and we battered each other. Absolutely battered each other.
Proper old football. Ball,
at every stage, you know, Desi's elbow up into your jaw. Obviously, I was a much cleaner player than Desi. So we battered each other. But I'll never forget after the game. Big embrace, a big hug, a handshake, a stud talking to me on the pitch after the game. That's the sort of character Desi always was. Tough, hard, nothing asked in terms of quarters asked or given, but always would go toe-to-toe and forgive immediately after the game. Also meeting, I think, the Dubs, that experience a loyal man, a man that will have absolute loyalty of the players, the fans, the county board, the clubs, and of course the supporters. So a very loyal character they're bringing in to follow on from Jim, who's had an incredible legacy. And I know sometimes when I'm on Off the Ball, you guys are giving me feedback, and sometimes your listeners were giving me feedback on Twitter or whatever and saying that you use too many superlatives, and I do use too many superlatives. But obviously the last 5 years under Jim, it's hard to use superlatives. It's just been an amazing legacy that he's left. The exciting thing is that Dublin now bringing in a very powerful leader who knows Dublin inside out, who knows the players inside out, who knows the club structure inside out, who knows the Dublin jersey inside out. I think his book was famously called Tangled Up in Blue. Desi Farrell has been the epitome of Tangled Up in Blue his whole life.
From your perspective, though, and like from the psychological perspective of this job, and it's
the pitfalls that it entails in terms of the narrative of like success for the last 5 years. What's his biggest challenge?
Well, Johnny, it's funny, even over the last 7 months, I've been listening to you guys a good bit. I've been traveling all around the world on work in the last maybe 6 months around the world this year, from places like Puerto Rico to obviously Tokyo. And when I get a chance to try to tune into you boys and I hear you talking, Johnny and Adrian, about soccer and rugby and obviously Gaelic games and so on, and I'm loving the banter, and it keeps me, I guess, at home when I'm away. But Johnny, since, I guess, the last time I met with you boys, I probably haven't been good enough at articulating what we're doing now for a living. The psychological aspect of what we do is probably now at most 5%. The rest is about leadership. It's about coaching. It's about high performance. It's about building high-performance environments. It's about developing the infrastructures to support performance in the world's leading businesses and, of course, in professional sport. So with that perspective, I would say Dublin are getting a really strong man. They're getting a man who understands the psychology, to answer your previous point, Johnny, but they're also getting a guy who's a strong coach. They're getting a strong leader. They're getting a guy who technically understands play very well, both offensively and, yes, defensively. They're getting a guy who's strong with younger players, good emotional intelligence, knows how to put his arm around a guy, and knows how to challenge a guy, whether it's in the change room or whether it's maybe in a one-on-one scenario. And I've seen him in action as the Dublin coach when he was involved with the Dublin Miners. He would have brought us in a few times to help out from a leadership and teamship point of view. So from that, all those perspectives, Johnny, I think Dublin are getting a very strong character.
Yeah, a guy that you've obviously worked with, as you said, and any chance that you're going to get involved here at some very early days, obviously, in his trajectory here as Dublin manager, but any chance that you'll get involved at some point?
No, I don't think there's any chance, to be honest. I've far too much on my plate. And maybe in 5 years' time, when I slow down a little bit traveling around the world, I'd love to get involved with a team. But at the moment, Adrian, I've no bandwidth to get involved with a team at home with probably now another year and a half, very little free time.
Can I ask you as well, you mentioned Tokyo and your role over there, and you've been involved with the RFU over the last number of years. What was your role in Tokyo?
So for the last 6 years I've been involved with Ireland, it's been a hell of a positive journey overall. Obviously what they've won on the pitch has been incredible in terms of the Grand Slam highlights, like lowlights. I can't put any sugarcoating on that, but a lot of lowlights at the World Cup, in particular the Japan defeat, and in particular the New Zealand defeat. What was my role? The same as it has been for the last 6 years, helping out with the mental prep, being there as a sounding board for the leadership group, being there as a sounding board for the staff, and of course, in terms of the coaches. So under one heading, probably the mental prep, support with leaders and support with coaches and staff.
Yeah, I'm sure the David Nosifora comments over the last couple of weeks haven't been lost on you. People have missed it. It's to try and summarise here, and there was lots of them. Fallout of it, obviously, has been deep and may continue. But David Nosifora particularly, if you don't mind me reading this quote that he gave in relation to the mental approach, I suppose, the psychological approach. He said, to be able to manage the stress and expectation of performance, I really do believe it's an important area for us to look at and service better. He says, the whole area of psychology has to be improved, as well as health and well-being. If we continue to do well and manage to get ourselves back up to the top again or near the top, we need to be able to manage that better and drive performance better by supporting everyone better. What did you think when you read that, when you saw that?
Well, first of all, being very transparent, I would have sat down with David a month ago and we had a very strong debrief. I have huge respect for David Nosifora. I've been working very closely with him over the last 5 years, so a huge respect for David. What did I think when I read that? Well, first of all, I discussed it with David for nearly 2.5 hours, about 4 or 5 weeks ago. So we had a very in-depth conversation. When David's saying that, I can assure you, he's not pointing the finger at me, or he's not pointing the finger at Joe or about the players. He's saying we as a nation, in terms of rugby, need to significantly raise the bar in the mental preparation of the squad. I would agree with that. I would absolutely agree with that. Now, you might say, but Enda, why was this not done? Was your role not to do this? I would have to hold my hands up and say, in retrospect, there's a lot of things I would do differently. If I didn't say that, guys, you'd say, Enda, you're either arrogant or you're insane.
And what would you say if you were to pinpoint some of those things?
Well, in terms of what we do differently, you'd probably start back with a culture. You start back with the culture of rugby in general, and say that we need to start when players are 17 or 18 years of age. Yes, their strength and conditioning is imperative, but so too is their mental conditioning. And you'd be glad to know, and I've said it probably loud and clear on Youth Talk, but also in clubs around the country and now in clubs around the world, we're saying that integrate your mental preparation in with all other aspects of prep. It isn't a half an hour prep you do on a, let's say, on a Friday afternoon. So it's something that should be integrated. That's one of the things I would strongly suggest. And David is very open to that. And the coaches in the RFU are very open to now.
Are you saying that that was something that didn't happen then, Enda, or didn't happen to the extent that it might have done?
No, it did happen. So again, I have to go back and commend Joe. Joe was brought in a culture whereby the mental preparation is almost brought in every single conversation. In every team meeting for the last 5 years, and I've sat ahead a lot of them, in every team meeting for the last 5 years, Joe Schmidt would have brought up the mental prep, first of the prep we were doing together that we would have collaborated on. And I assure you of that. There's no sugarcoating in that whatsoever. Now, I can say that mental prep needs to be more vigorous. We need to get much more, let's say, measured in that. We need to now train our coaches around the country on the mental preparation as well as we do on the technical, tactical, physical, and even lifestyle.
Yeah. He talked about the players and the staff not coping with success. Was that something that you'd sensed that sort of post-2018 that it became increasingly difficult to tackle that idea that we were headed for the world number one team and we weren't coping with it that well?
Well, I think that we should have responded better when we were number one in the world, when we had beaten every team in the world, when we were absolutely rocking. I think maybe we should have interrogated our thinking a bit more vigorously so that we were prepared for that first England game in the Six Nations and then obviously prepared to build momentum right throughout the year heading towards, obviously, Japan. Now, you'd say that we beat Scotland, so we actually the momentum was excellent that week. The buzz around the squad was excellent. The boys were firing. The staff were firing. Everything was excellent. And then, obviously, the Japan defeat really was a big body blow, a major body blow, because from a confidence, a morale, and yes, momentum, it was a huge shot.
Yeah. What can you say to players like when you're, because even obviously the England result is one that's pointed to as a major sort of a red flag at that time where we were like, yeah. Jesus, actually, maybe this is not going to go exactly as a nation. We were certainly thinking that way. Maybe this isn't going to go exactly as we thought it was. What can you do with players and staff at that point? Like, is it almost too late to turn the juggernaut, if I can use that expression, at that stage because it's so close or in the Japan case actually during the tournament?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely possible to change it. I actually met Quinny a lot over there. Me and Quinny had a lot of chats on pitch side before training or after training. Or maybe even actually we're chatting with him in the tunnel before the All Blacks game, which is a good experience. The All Blacks are coming out of the tunnel and the Irish players coming out of the tunnel. I had a good chat with Quinny down there. So whenever we were chatting during the World Cup in Tokyo, we were actually talking about that, talking about, you know, how to turn things around. My whole life I've been part of sports teams and business teams that turn things around very quickly. So yes, you can turn it around. We obviously didn't do it well enough, Adrian. We obviously didn't do it vigorously enough. Maybe, and Joe has spoken about this over the last number of weeks, maybe after England defeat, maybe we should have really responded and thought, okay, to a certain extent, let's scrap trying to do well in the Six Nations. That's when I put all of our focus, our entire focus, into the World Cup. But I can't point the fingers at anybody else. Again, I point the finger at myself.
He was saying that actually that maybe there was too much of that. Maybe there was too much focus on being hung up at trying to get to a World Cup semi-final.
Yeah, but my point there is, in terms of maybe giving more players a little more game time. For example, Joey was badly injured coming up to the World Cup. Johnny obviously was injured in the World Cup. Jack's game time wasn't as significant. So in terms of getting them more game time during that period, might have impacted a result against Scotland, but would have had a huge impact heading towards the World Cup.
Mm. Yeah. Like as a nation, it feels like we're scarred by this impossible, mission impossible.
Well, I wouldn't be scarred. I learned more in 10 weeks in Japan and the previous camp than I have probably in the last 10 years. I wouldn't be scarred. I think we need to learn. That's the big thing, and that's one of the things that used to annoy me about Armagh, that rather than being scarred, can we learn from it? And that's one of the things that David and the staff and RFU are trying to do. Trying to learn. Andy Farrell is a formidable coach. A formidable coach. I can't emphasise that enough.
What's he like psychologically, I suppose, versus Schmidt? Have they any similarities?
What's he like psychologically? He's a different style of leadership than Joe, and I'm sure Andy and Joe would both say that. What's he like psychologically in terms of, do you mean in terms of his understanding of the mental part of the game or do you mean what's he like psychologically, personality wise?
Yeah, I suppose the former, in that he's, you're coming from the car crash of the World Cup. It's kind of like rebuilding from the rubble, from like a nation that was on top of the world and now is in rubble. So he's got a, you know, is he going to grasp that by the, you know, is he going to be kind of ready to bring in new players? But psychologically, can he bring the players up to the level that, because as you say, after that Japan game was a body blow, and I don't think the Irish team has gotten over that yet.
Yeah, well, I have no doubt in Andy's ability to get players back up. I have no doubt in his courage. If you look at any of the footage of Andy playing, there's no question about his courage. Also, he's very tactically astute, because when we look at the World Cup, I know that David mentioned, obviously, the mental performance of the team, and I know that was widely spoken about afterwards. You know, it's a whole kaleidoscope of preparation. It's all aspects of prep, not just one aspect. So Andy's overall understanding of performance is excellent, and he'd be very strong at empowering the staff around him to get the best out of the players that are currently there and the next generation. Some of the big highlights of the World Cup was the performance of Gary Ringrose. From a mental point of view, his performance as guys were outstanding. So some aspects of mental performance was outstanding, and the technical, tactical performance and the leadership performance was outstanding. Some aspects of the preparation, by the way, were exceptional. I'll give you one vignette into that. The logistics, the team cohesion done before the World Cup, the strength and conditioning, the level of work done to make sure we were the recce and everything done in every venue. It was done meticulously for the last 2 years. So a lot of that actually needs to be kept intact, as we would have discussed that time with David. And there's other aspects, of you, as you guys have alluded to, and as I've alluded to, it needs to be significantly improved.
Yeah. Your time with the RFU, you finished, and I know, has that come to the end of that cycle, or are you still involved, do you think?
But to be honest, I don't know. I'm having a meeting this week with RFU. I don't know, Adrian. I have to say, it's been a hell of a journey. Like, for the RFU to bring me in 6 years ago, under Declan Kidney, it was Declan's last year, then moving to Joe's first year. It's been amazing. I'm very thankful for everything there if you have involved me. And like, Joe's journey has been awesome in terms of victories. And yes, some big defeats that has hurting us. And will hurt us probably forever. It'll hurt Joe forever. Look at the amount of time that man's put into this. It'll hurt people like Rory. I feel for Rory, another Armagh man. I really feel for Rory that it'll end it in that way. But thankfully, in Rory's house at home in Armagh, there's a lot of pictures of incredible memories. So my time with Ireland, I don't know whether it'll continue. What I do know is I'll continue to learn. I'll continue to work with the best teams in business and sport in the world, and we'll continue to move forward.
Yeah, and you've been brilliant with your time as always. Thanks a million. Best of luck over the next few weeks, whatever it holds.
Good to talk to you guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And McNulty on the line there discussing Desi Farrell's appointment with Dublin and his own time with the Ireland team as well. Right, it is 9:24 on this Friday morning, Johnny.
Do you buy into sports psychology, or are you kind of, you know, you've people very sceptical about it?
I think it's got its place. Brian O'Driscoll cites Enda as a guy who sort of towards the latter end of his career firmly got him back on track.
I'm sceptical, but I believe in it as well, if that makes sense. I wouldn't necessarily agree with everything Enda was saying in terms of its role across like the whole country and rugby all the way up, like how big you must make mental preparation. I mean, ultimately, you have to do better than your bloody opponent and win the game and get your tactics right. And mentally, you should try to be on a fairly level platform across the year. But you mentioned Conor Murray. So you look at Conor Murray and some other players, that Conor has been more out of form maybe than in form for the last whatever. So like, I think that's where someone like Enda can kind of maybe make a difference. And he cites Armagh as well, where you can... you have to learn from Armagh or perennial, you know, failure. Never... kind of considered all Ireland prospects, but they had that mental resolve to do it, and I think the DUP could do with some psychology this morning. And if he gave Arlene Foster a ring, he might have something to say to her.
I doubt he will. She's a big GA fan, isn't she?
Well, she was at the
Fermanagh game, was it last year?
Was Joe Brawley's line that one of the greatest achievements was to get her to sit through an hour
Rory
or 10
Gallagher
minutes of Rory Gallagher's footballer. But she's an interesting morning ahead of her.
Wow, says Fela McInamara, someone in Irish sport who isn't attempting to pass the book. Massive credit to Enda.
So. I know Fela. He shares most of my passions in life. Likes the best from Galway, and I'm sure he's buzzing for the year ahead on the Gaelic Games front.
Right, we are getting back to our most memorable moment of the decade.
The moment for being cheats will always be cheats. Amateur boxing stinks from the core right to the top.
I absolutely love that accent. Right to that tap. He's proper Belfast. He wasn't holding back.
Shane Lowry versus Johnny Sexton.
I think the people around me really believed that I could, which helps me an awful lot. I do remember a lot of times in the past when I'm down on myself and serious chats with Neil, he always reminded me that he always said that I was going to win one. At least one, he said. So, you know, I suppose when you have the people around you really believing you, it helps you an awful lot. So, yeah, obviously, look, I'm Irish. I grew up holing putts on the putting green back home to win the Open. Like, it was always the Open, wasn't it? And I watched Paddy winning his two Opens. I mean, I didn't even know him back then. And I'm obviously very good friends with him. To have him there on the 18th, like, you go into Paddy's house and his claret jug is sitting there on the kitchen table, and I'm going to have one on my kitchen table now as well. So I said that to him. That's going to be quite nice. And Yeah,
delighted to say that Shane's coach and the Golfing Union of Ireland's national coach, Neil Manship, joins us on the line. Good morning to you, Neil.
Good morning, how are you?
Flying the thanks. I presume that takes you back to a pretty awesome weekend of the summer.
It does, yeah. You never get tired of hearing all those discussions and recollecting all the memories from Portrush. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Like the it's obviously it's in one of our most memorable moments of the decade, up against Johnny Sexton's drop goal against France. So it's in tough territory, but doing well so far over the first hour is anything to go by. It had all the ingredients, Neil, hadn't it? Like, in terms of the first Open in Ireland in 70 years, first Irishman to win it on Irish soil. It was close enough to wire to wire as well. It had all the ingredients of just an unbelievable week, really, for somebody who's probably one of the, if not the most loved Irish sports person at the minute.
That's right. It was an amazing week, and as you say, very close to a wire-to-wire, getting off to a great start on Thursday, shooting 4-under, which was a great settler and just brilliant to get off to a really solid start in what was probably the biggest tournament of his career so far, playing the Open at home at Portrush and all the crowds there and all the setup. It was just a brilliant start to the week, and we didn't know what lay ahead at that stage, but that was a really good start to things.
One of the maybe most surprising aspects of it afterwards was his own comments about how he couldn't help but early in that final round start to think about winning the thing, and how Bo was starting to have to talk him back into it and sort of get his mind back in the game, I suppose, to take each shot at a time. Were you in the rope, inside the ropes at that point, or where are you when all that's unfolding?
No, we'd be outside the rope, so it'd just be himself and Bo and 1,000 photographers and cameramen. But no, we would talk about that, and it's important to let yourself think ahead like that, because I mean, you can't not think about it. It's such an incredible prize to think about winning, and then important to get back to the next shot, which Bo was absolutely fantastic at helping Shane to do.
So if you're outside the ropes, is your involvement next to nil at that point, or is there anything you can still do?
My involvement is trying to see the shots, which was very difficult at times, taking notes, keeping the statistics that we do. And but pretty much a spectator apart from that.
What state of mind are you in then? If he's starting to think, Jesus, I might win this thing. What state of mind are you in during the final day?
Very similar to him. I mean, thinking ahead of what could happen, but also getting back to the next shot, taking notes and everything that was going. We discussed the game plan before going out, and I was very confident that Shane was going to play really well on the final day. You never know how anyone else is going to do. We did discuss a lot about how the weather forecast looked, and it really played out how it was forecasted, where it was going to be really rough for a few holes and then pass over. So we did feel that it was going to be very hard for somebody to make a really good charge and shoot a low score like he did on Saturday. So much of it was a kind of case of trying to play very sensible golf and keeping mistakes off.
Like, was that the game plan going into the week, and sort of how much of that charge, sort of putting the foot in the accelerator versus maybe healing off a small bit, how much of that is very tactics focused or sort of round dependent?
Well, the one thing is, Shane knows the course really well from having played in the north of Ireland there for many years. Okay, the new holes on the 7th and the 8th were different. We went up to practice a couple of weeks before the Open, got a good look at those. So he did know the course very well, won the north of Ireland there in 2008. So in terms of playing the course tactically, that was already there. And then just playing the conditions we had during the week. But there was no great talk of, you know, trying to get off to a fast start or trying not to play badly, that kind of thing. It was really just take one shot at a time and see how it all went. Because it was such a huge occasion. There was obviously going to be a lot of emotion involved right from the start. A lot of family at watching, family and friends from all over Ireland. So it was just a great occasion to look forward to, but we certainly didn't predict it was going to end up the way it did.
No. Given the gap going into the final round, the whatever the 63 on the Saturday, just an unbelievable round that I know he's checked as, you know, one of the obviously greatest of his career, given the context of it. But given that there was only one player inside six shots, what was the conversation on Saturday night about the game plan for Sunday?
Well, yeah, Tommy was four behind, and then I think JB Holmes was six behind. So there was that nice lead, but I mean, it could turn into a very small lead or no lead very quickly, or it could turn into a bigger lead quickly as well. So we discussed around those things that, you know, after five or six holes, you might be six or seven ahead. After, you know, the same amount of holes, you might be level, you might be one behind. But whatever situation you're in, play the next shot, because it all adds up at the end. I mean, when he won in Abu Dhabi, he went four shots behind after being four shots ahead at the start. That was after 11 holes and ended up winning there. So no matter what happens, hang in there and play the next shot, because you never know how other people are going to do, and all you can do is influence your next shot. And whether that lead you have at the start has gone early or increased early really doesn't matter as much. It's just putting your attention on the next shot and playing as well as you can.
Just on that, Neil, like if you're on the final day of the Open, how, like, what percentage is talent, what percentage is literally just mental strength at that stage?
Well, very much mental strength. I mean, very much accessing the skills that you've accumulated over the years and having the wherewithal and patience and awareness to play shots you're comfortable with, to pick good targets and stick to your game plan, no matter what's going on.
Mm. And you, is that something you either have or you haven't, or is something you learn over time? We've you know, kind of a performance coach on there. Like, it's such that, if particularly if things start to go off kilter and go a little bit awry, that... Is it a thing that's innately there, or is it something you learn that, listen, I'm going to deal with this setback and everything is fine?
No, it's a skill as well, and it can absolutely be learned and developed and enhanced and bettered, and no different to any other skill. It can certainly be improved upon, but a lot of it does come from experience and maybe understanding how you may have made life difficult for yourself in the past, and of course trying to force shots or being a bit defensive or worrying too much what other people are doing or thinking too many holes ahead and trying not to make mistakes. So no, it's certainly a very strong skill and a very important skill about accessing the talent that you have when you need it, because you're not going to learn any new skills at that stage. It's accessing the skills that you have, playing the next shot as well as you can, playing shots you're comfortable with, picking good targets and committing to the decisions that you make. Because nobody else can put you off, you know. The target's not moving, the ball's not moving until you hit it. Nobody's going to tackle you. It's all up to you to deal with the next shot.
And as somebody who doesn't really follow golf, where does Shane rank in that regard in terms of the quality of players from 0 to 100 or whatever in terms of mentality to get through, particularly in the last day?
Well, you'd see over tournaments that he's played both as an amateur. I mean, he's won the Irish Open as an amateur, which is an incredible achievement, a real fairy tale. And then to go on and do this, the second coming of that 10 years later. So, I mean, he definitely has a very high level of awareness and just bottle and heart and guts and the will to do his best, no matter what's going on around him. He hasn't done it every single time he's played. He would say that himself, but certainly learning from other experiences. But he certainly has a very strong head and a lot of guts and the ability to do it when it matters most.
And a big year ahead, Neil. Potentially trips out east and lots of big moments ahead, potentially in 2020. What are the targets for the next year? Have you set them out yet?
Yeah, targets would be around, you know, the Ryder Cup coming up later on in the year. And before that, really excited about the Olympics. The two Irish players that will be there will be the top two Irish players in the rankings, in the Olympic rankings, which at the moment Rory's number 2 and Shane is number 12. So both very, very highly ranked. So it looks at the moment that the team will be Rory and Shane for Tokyo right at the end of July. So that's a really exciting thing to look forward to. We were out looking at the golf course just northwest of Tokyo and Kasumigaseki back in October. Beautiful golf course, will really suit the two lads there. Yeah, we're all looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, listen, best of luck for the year ahead. Thanks, Billy, for taking the call. He's doing well in the poll, by the way.
This is going to be a hack canter.
I think he's going to get there.
Yeah, we would have, I think...
another one in the can for 2019.
Even if he voted for Johnny Sexton, I think it wouldn't make a difference. It's the people's vote.
Yeah. Neil, thanks, Billy.
Democracy does work, despite what we've seen the last day or so.
Thanks a lot, Neil Manship, coach to Shane Lowry and for the Golfing Union.
Does democracy work? Is it time to revise democracy? If democracy can decree that two buffoons can be elected in America and Britain like that, and it was like Boris Johnson was the leader by default because he replaced Theresa May, which is fine, but the British public then voted
for democracy works. It doesn't mean it's always going to deliver the outcome that you want.
Well, no, that's fine, but the outcome that I want should at least be an outcome that is vaguely sane.
I mean, but we're very well educated. If I was sitting here with somebody that was of a different leaning, that we've got to get the hell out of here. But if I'm sitting with somebody here who was a different leaning, they'd say, well, my
there's nothing to do with leaning. It's sanity. I'm only talking about sanity. I would elect you, Adrian, before I'd elect Boris Johnson.
No, this is really the indictment of the morning.
And I hope you would elect me.
No, absolutely no circumstances.
We're not going anywhere. we're here for another hour.
Enjoy supporting your newly adopted province.
Yeah, let's catch up at some stage and go through the breakdown. of society and the game.
Oh, sorry, I thought we were having the game. Thanks, William, for coming in.
Not at all. We'll be on the off the ball racing very soon. So obviously,
stay tuned for that a bit later on. Friday Night Racing on the way. That is it from us on a slightly extended OTB AM this morning. Don't forget that coming up over the weekend. Tomorrow from 1 o'clock is Off the Ball, and then again from Sunday with Manchester United Everton from 2 with Stephen Doyle and Brian Kerr. We'll have Nathan Murphy and Gary Breen. At Arsenal against City from 4:30, Colm Keyes and Kieran O'Rahilly will be on the Sunday newspaper review as well. If you've missed anything from this morning, go check out the podcast up on offtheball.com or wherever it is you get your podcasts. And it's fully timestamped. You can scroll through the podcast wherever you want and land on whatever it is you need. You've got Kenny Cunningham up there. You've got Kieran Cunningham previewing the new reign of the new Dublin manager, Desi Farrell. Alan Quinlan of the weekend's rugby and fascinating stuff as well. From Andy McNulty on his time at the IRFU, and Shane Lowry, as you've just been hearing, his coach Neil Manship. That's it from us for this morning. Off the Ball live from 7 o'clock tonight. Good morning.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.